It seems the vice president, as you must know by now, went out hunting with a buddy of his, a millionaire, and I guess the vice president was in a hurry to get something, got instead the millionaire in the chest, in the face, not good. He's in intensive care. The vice president is probably, I heard he was at his side, probably saying, I'm really sorry. The vice president shot a guy by mistake. Imagine that. Imagine how, well, I don't know. His heart must be all right. That's all I can say. Record-setting snow buries northeast. That's a headline. Record-breaking storm buried sections of the northeast under more than about 2 feet of snow on Sunday. In fact, actually, it's a record. The old record was 26.4 inches. This time, they got 26.9 inches. We're going to have more and more record-breaking weather. More on that in a little bit. Unheeded warnings, poor planning, and apathy in recognizing the scope of Hurricane Katrina's destruction led to the slow emergency response from the White House on down to local parishes. Now, that's the result of a House investigation, a 600-page report. And I wonder how much that cost. I'm sure that quite a few of you probably could have come up with that for quite a bit less. What do you think? Unheeded warnings. Poor planning and apathy. That took 600 pages of government work to generate. In a moment, as Paul would say, the rest of the story. Just like a cat. My webcam photograph tonight is of Dusty. She is I think she's the youngest member of the household now. I don't know if it's Dusty or Abydos, but I think Dusty. Anyway, she is truly a beautiful cat. And, that was taken very close to her. So she's not as big as you think, but she's certainly getting big. And when we got her, she could walk around in the palm of my hand. I mean, Dusty was a little one. And all day long today, I've been trying to teach her to jump up on my lap, and she got very close. So wouldn't you know, just a minute and a half ago, she came strolling in here while I'm on the air and sat there thinking about jumping up on my lap and started to, and I went, oh, Dusty, we tried all day, and now you want to get up here. Anyway, that's Dusty in the photograph. Dr. Hansen, I want to talk to you now. Would somebody out there, please, acquainted with the famous Dr. Hansen, who said to hell with you, NASA. Well, he didn't say that's not a direct quote, but I mean, he really wants to talk, and they really don't want him to talk. He said the ocean's temperatures off Santa Barbara are now the highest in 1,400 years. That was Dusty you just heard. I don't know if you heard that or not. After she's out, she doesn't like it. After that speech and the release of data by Dr. Hansen on December 15th showing that 2005 was the warmest year in at least a century, officials at NASA headquarters repeatedly phoned public affairs officers who relayed the warning to Dr. Hansen that there would be, quote, dire consequences, end quote, if such statements continued. Those officers said Dr. Hansen said in interviews, among the restrictions, according to Dr. Hansen, and an internal draft memorandum he reported to the LA Times, was that his supervisors could stand in for him in any news media interviews. Oh, come on, doctor. Dr. Hansen and some of his colleagues said interviews were canceled as a result. Now, Dr. Hansen is speaking out despite NASA's best wishes, and I want to interview you, doctor. So, those close to Dr. Hansen, please tell him he's got an open, nationwide platform. He's obviously got the cojones to do this kind of thing. Well, I've got an ear. I've got a microphone, Dr. Hansen. Let's rock. January, well, by the way, coming up next hour is Howard Bloom, brilliant, absolutely brilliant man. January was a fair weather friend regarding the warmest January on record, allowing Americans to save a lot of money on their heating. But like all good things, it seems to have come to an end. The country's average temp for the month, 39.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be, get this, folks, 8.5 degrees above average for January. On the other hand, while much of the U.S. was basking in warm weather, parts of Europe and Asia were battered by bitter cold. Climate details for the rest of the world for January are expected to be available perhaps next week. A lot of records getting made. Workers at the Grandfather Mountain area described an unreal scene about a couple of weeks ago now, actually, when record wind gusts of at least 200 miles an hour battered the North Carolina tourist attraction in the Northwest Mountains. Can you imagine that? In excess, probably, of 200 miles an hour. Our workers who were inside the visitor center said it was very much like a tornado, a whirlwind, inside the building after, that is to say, said Cray Morton, the windows broke. Morton said staff members didn't know how strong the northwest winds really blew late Tuesday night and early Wednesday. National Weather Service approved anemometer measures only 200 miles an hour. Morton said the gusts got to that level several times, actually exceeded that mark. That broke the Grandfather Mountain record of 195.5 miles an hour set on April 18th, 1997. So, Is anybody out there, raise your hand, is anybody left out there? Dusty, you're not coming in. Is anybody left out there who doesn't believe that we really are entering a time of record after record after record with regard to the weather falling by the wayside? Anybody left? I don't see any hands. A Russian astronomer has predicted that Earth is going to experience a, quote, mini ice age in the middle of this century caused by low solar activity. Well, according to that, then we should be in it right now. Solar activity has been just pathetically small. We are at the bottom of the sun cycle right now, probably within maybe less than a year of the bottom. Nobody knows for sure until the sun switches polarity, and then we'll know that it occurred, but we're very near the bottom. Anyway, this Russian scientist in St. Petersburg said Monday that temperatures are going to begin falling 6 or 7 years from now when global warming caused by increased solar activity in the 20th century reaches its peak. The coldest period is going to occur 15 to 20 years after a major solar output decline, which will occur between 2035 and 2045. This is wild stuff. It comes from Physics Web, and it's about ball lightning. If you've ever seen a mysterious ball of lightning chasing a cow or maybe flying through your window during a thunderstorm, take comfort from the fact that you've witnessed a very rare phenomena. Indeed, ball lightning, a slow-moving ball of light that is occasionally seen at ground levels during thunderstorms, has puzzled scientists now for centuries, but now researchers in Israel, get this, have built a system that can create lightning balls in the lab. The work may not only help us to understand ball lightning, but could even lead to practical applications that make use of these artificial balls. Ball lightning is thought to be a ball of plasma that's formed when a bolt of lightning hits the ground and creates a molten, in quotes, hot spot. Now, the ball can typically measure 30 centimeters across, can last for a few seconds, though they're generally created during thunderstorms. Eli Gerby and Vladimir Victor from Tel Aviv University in Israel have now been able to make lightning balls in the lab using a microwave drill. Check this out. The device consists of the magnetron from your average 600-watt domestic microwave oven. And it concentrates all the power into a volume of just 1 cubic centimeter. Don't try this at home. but I'm sure tempted to. The researchers inject the microwaves through a pointed rod into a solid substrate made from glass, silicon, germanium, alumina, or other ceramics. The energy from the microwaves then will produce a molten hotspot in the substrate. What the scientists do then is pull the microwave drill out of the solid, which drags the molten hotspot and creates a hot drop. This hot drop then becomes a floating fireball, plasma, folks, that measures about 3 centimeters across, lasts for some tens of milliseconds. The fireball looks just like a hot jellyfish quivering, said Jerby, and in fact, buoyant in the air. So if, they did this with an average microwave oven and a little more, that really sounds like fun at home, huh? But again, don't try that at home, even though I'm sorely tempted. Astronomers have discovered what they call an Earth-like planet. You may have heard this, orbiting a distant star. It's a big discovery, Earth-like planet. They feel they're finally getting close to a possible discovery of alien life. They're searching for another relatively small rocky planet where temperatures are neither too hot nor too cold for life to exist. You know, in parenthesis, it should say, as we know it. But doesn't. I added that. Most of the planets we discover are huge, gaseous things like Jupiter. And the only reason that we're discovering those is because they're big enough to be seen. You know, the way astronomers are seeing these planets now is by looking at a star and then watching for something to blink. Well, that used to puzzle them. Why do we see it blink out every now and then? Well, the reason is because planets are passing between our view of that star, and we have light interruptus. Do, in fact, other worlds exist beyond planets? Non-scientists speak frequently, as you know, of other dimensions, like Michio Kaku, and people who have had UFO encounters often say they think it's where ETs come from. Quantum physicists call these parallel universes, or brain worlds, that's B-R-A-N-E, worlds, membrane-like places where there are more than the simple three dimensions that we have here on Earth, four dimensions if you include time. Do these other worlds really exist? Researchers are discovering definitely do. A neutrino detector at the South Pole called Amanda, what a nice name, has detected ghost-like particles from space that could act as probes to a world of more dimensions than exist here on Earth. This is from Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country. Neutrinos are particles that are similar to electrons, but they do not carry an electric charge. Because neutrinos are electrically neutral, they're not affected by the electromagnetic forces which act on electrons and can travel great distances without being affected by gravity. They can thus be spotted because they travel in a straight line rather than a curve. Earlier research into parallel universes postulated that everything that is possible to happen does happen somewhere in some universe. This could explain things like mediums who contact the dead. You see, they'd somehow be entering another universe where the person being contacted had not died. Quantum theories have now evolved to embrace the idea of worlds with more or fewer dimensions than ours, and physicists think these other universes may exist all around us. But of course, we're unaware of them. And now scientists are trying to find them. A Radio Shack in southwestern Canada, stop me if you've heard this, has been plagued by paranormal activity, many locals believing the store events are a sign of the end. The end of everything or Radio Shack? Some employees have heard a pedometer chanting the Lord's Prayer backwards. That's right, you heard correctly. A pedometer sitting in the store chanting the Lord's Prayer backwards. That would be concerning. The Radio Shack looks like any other. They have PCs, they have radios, they're unidentifiable cables and electronic devices, but this retail outlet has something that all the other stores don't. The talking pedometer is possessed, says an attractive young employee. Every few days or so, the tinny, lurching female voice announcing how many steps this stationary pedometer has taken and echoes through the store while I work at it. Then it stops immediately when I walk around the corner to shut it off. Other employees have had run-ins with the talking pedometer. Some employees have heard the pedometer chanting the Lord's Prayer backwards. The pedometer told a regional manager that it would take him to hell. I'm sorry I hadn't read this part. Let me read that again. The pedometer told a regional manager that it would take him to hell. And once the pedometer held a 10-minute conversation with an employee on why selling $30 USB cables is evil. I hadn't read this before. I didn't get down this far. This is just the latest in a long string of events. Recently, a dual-headed display computer arrived at the store, but they didn't order one, and no one's been able to figure out who sent it. Last summer, Vatican and Sprint officials were called in to investigate the PCS guy cardboard stand-up that was crying blood. This can't be real. Vatican officials have yet to comment on the incident. While the cardboard man is gone now, the feeling of doom and bloodstained carpet remains. So if you're in a Radio Shack in southwestern Canada and a pedometer begins talking to you, you may want to consider a hasty exit. Now, it's from a news service called SNN in Burnaby. All right, SSN in Burnaby. If you want to try to verify that story, that's the source. Now, here's a story that makes all kinds of sense to me. You know, most of the colds, the illness, the flu, the terrible things that happen to us in America, around the world, in fact, they occur because we pass a virus from person to person, right? And any halfway informed medical official will tell you very quickly that the way to stop all of this, well, most of it anyway, is, for God's sakes, wash your hands. Or if here in the West, as is the case, I mean, people meet each other and men stick out their hands and you shake hands. A good hearty handshake, right? Well, wrong. Here is an article by George H. Russell, which suggests don't shake hands, instead bow for health. I believe, he says, that we could vastly improve the health of our citizenry and save billions of dollars, billions, that is, in costs associated with colds, flu, and other illnesses, if we as Americans would simply adopt the practice of bowing when greeting each other. Let's all turn Japanese. Millions of Americans at any given time are infected with various viruses, the symptoms of which often are concealed by the use of a vast array of medications you can get over the counter, which allow sick people not to look sick, and they can keep working, but they're going to spread this thing like the Black Plague. And so I think George Russell is dead flat right. What we need to do is to either get manic about washing our hands, or we need to take, turn Japanese. And instead of shaking hands, simply bow. It's a wonderful gesture of respect and greeting and goodbye. And really, it's not bad at all, except for people with bad backs. And so I think it's a grand idea, and it would stop so much disease. What do you folks say? In addition to getting rid of the godforsaken time change we have to go through twice a year, what do you say we stop shaking hands? I assume you may have looked outside. It's a great big moon out there, full last night, I think, and very full tonight, just bathing the desert in bright moonlight. Good morning. First time caller line, you are on the air.
Hi, Art. This is Matt from Seattle.
Hi, Matt.
I've just been watching the miniseries Taken on video.
Oh, Taken. Yes, I, too, bought the DVD set and watched Taken. And I've got to say, and I'm going to say that Dakota Fanning did the acting job of a little child's lifetime. I had never seen anything like that in my whole life. God, it was incredible.
Yeah, it's something. I was wondering, are you going to have anything on Richard Hoagland in the future?
Am I going to have anything on Richard Hoagland?
Yeah,
probably. I would imagine so, yes.
Anything about the Mars or what have you?
Yes, if there is big breaking news about Mars, he'd be the guy, I guess, huh?
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yes, it is indeed interesting. Anybody else out there see Dakota Fanning in Taken? My God, she was incredible. I mean, there was so much adult behind that little child's eyes, and her speech pattern, everything about her was so much perfection in Taken. Any of the rest of you react to her that way? I thought she was just brilliant. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
I think Dakota Fanning is about 40 years old in a little child's body.
Yeah, man, you're right.
Look here, Art, I caught your show last evening and you were talking to your guest about the DVD wars, the HD DVD wars that are
going
to happen.
Yes, Blu-ray versus HD.
Yes, sir. I have a HD DVD coming from a friend of mine in Japan. He works for Aflac there.
Well, listen,
I'm bringing it over.
Considered that. It's possible to go on the web and buy the Japanese version.
Yes, sir.
I'm well aware of that, but, you know, I kind of chickened out because it's all going to be in, it's going to come with an instruction book written in kanji.
I'm not looking forward to that.
People spend entire lifetimes trying to learn to speak, read that, so lots of ruck.
Well, let me say this. I believe the Blu-ray disc, which is probably a better format, because I had Beta, and I tried for years to convince my friends Beta was better than VHS.
Well, it was better.
It was better. Doggone sure was. But the HD DVD will play your old DVDs. Blu-ray will not.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
I heard that Blu-ray overcame that. Recent news was that they overcame that.
Well, I don't know if they did or not, sir. This guy also went to the Las Vegas, electronic show.
CES show, yeah.
But I tell you, I can't wait.
Well, that makes two of us.
A lot of folks don't realize though that the DVDs we've been buying for years are nowhere near high definition quality.
I know. I went out recently and bought a Sony HD camera.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and so let me tell you how much I'm waiting for Blu-ray. In other words, right now I'm storing this on the mini tapes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, mini DV, right?
But I'm salivating for Blu-ray.
I tell you what, I love that 16:9 ratio, the widescreen ratio.
Oh,
it's
baby.
Wonderful.
It certainly is.
But I'm going to tell you, I just cannot wait for this stuff to come out, and everybody's just salivating.
Well, you obviously can't wait. You ordered from Japan. Do me a favor and send me an email and tell me of your frustrations.
Well, it'll be here in the middle of March. he's being transferred back here to Columbus. That's where Aflac is stationed at.
All right. I'm looking forward to hearing from you about how you do with it, all right?
Fantastic, Art.
Take care, buddy. Yeah. So you can, if you wish, take a leap and order these things that are not ready for American distribution directly from Japan. But with it comes an instruction manual in Japanese. And so I'm trying to restrain myself. I'm always, I've always been out there on the edge of whatever technology is around. I've always been a high-quality video fan. So I'm very much into it. And Blu-ray, hurry up. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, this is Joe from Illinois.
Hello, Joe.
Yes, I'd like to talk about these good bacteria called probiotics.
Okay.
And I've given them to my mom after they gave her Cipro, and she felt worse after taking the Cipro than anything else I could do for her naturally. But
what was her problem? Why was she taking Cipro?
She had intestinal problems.
Okay, so some sort of infection.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, then after you use something as strong as that, of course, you've got to replace the cultures.
That's true. Plus, I also found out that most of these pharmaceutical antibiotics also contain these mycotoxins.
Mm-hmm.
And these are guys or little microorganisms, and they eat and defecate inside your intestines.
I don't want to hear this.
And the doctors don't give you anything to kill those off. They don't tell you what naturally it would take.
Great.
And
all right, so why are you telling me all this?
Well, it's just that I know that there are a lot of other people out there who are having problems, and they go to the doctors, and the doctors just want to keep filling you full of crap. And
that's subjective. I object to the word crap. Look, you can complain and bitch and moan all you want about antibiotics, but baby, without them, a lot of people would be dying of otherwise simple infections. So I think the weight of the argument's clearly on the side of the antibiotics. I know a lot of people object to them, but they save lives, millions of lives. So whatever downside they might have, the discovery of antibiotics is keeping a very large number of people alive. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Yes, hello. It is, again, a thrill to talk to you. I wanted to talk about ball lightning and whether or not you know if anybody is doing any research in terms of a DNA connection to ball lightning.
What do you mean, DNA?
Well, for instance, my, let's go back, 13, maybe make it 11 great-grandfathers, okay, and if you're still there, his name was James Otis, and he was a member of the Liberty Boys.
Okay, number one, we don't allow any last names on there.
Oh, I'm so sorry, he's a figure of history,
that's right.
It's like
Yeah, but we don't allow it. So this man...
He was killed when ball lightning came down the chimney and hit him in the head. And he lived for a while, but was not quite the same and would get into bar fights. He had a huge, apparently, schism in his personality, shall we say. And my mother, who is his direct descendant, and they're also descendants of a guy who signed himself on as an indentured servant of the Mayflower, and was a scoundrel and fought sword fights, etc. But my mother saw ball lightning once as a child in Illinois, southern Illinois, in an area around a barn, and then the second time. Likewise, down a hall and up a chimney in a house here in Southern California.
Well, I'd say that's just chance. What you're suggesting is that there's some sort of genetic propensity to see ball lightning, and I see no such connection at all. Just simple luck. I mean, a couple members of your family, separated by some generation, saw ball lightning. Interesting, but somewhat short of a direct connection to genetics. International Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Phil from Alberta.
Yes.
I was just wanted to mention, I'm feeling a little dispirited about the way America is perceiving Iran and the way we speak about it on the radio. Are you familiar, I'm sure you are, I assume you are, familiar with the acronym MAD?
Mutual Assured Destruction.
Correct, and I knew you would know that.
All right, speak up good and loud so I can hear you.
I knew you would know that.
Yes.
And we have a triad system, which is the planes and the ground and our submarines. We can unleash an insane amount of nuclear weaponry if necessary.
Yes.
Hopefully we'll just do a preemptive strike and take out their facilities.
Well, do you hope that, sir?
No, well, yes, actually, if we can verify that they are building or attempting to build nuclear weapons, I think either Israel or the United States should take a preemptive, not nuclear, just a preemptive strike to knock out the facilities, and if they go crazy, they're going to have to consider, because the other people around the head of the government do not, and they're smart, they're not dumb people, they do not want to get into a nuclear exchange with the United States and Israel, because they know that's a one-legged butt-kicking contest.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think probably we would be the ones to conduct the preemptive strike. I know Israel has done this sort of thing before. Are you still there? No, he's gone. We've done this sort of thing before, but my guess would be we have as much interest in seeing Iran not pursue nuclear weapons, as does Israel, since they no doubt fall into the hands of Islamic terrorists, and so we all know what would occur. So, yeah, I think we would probably conduct the strike. If Israel were to do it, the possibility of another Mideast war would be too great, and what the hell, everybody hates us already anyway. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello? Going once, going twice.
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. Turn your radio off.
My radio's off.
All right, proceed.
Yes, I'd like to go ahead and give a report. I'm not sure if...
On what?
On what I saw here last weekend. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina, for one.
Yes, sir.
And I noticed that we had the Secret Service, either CIA, sitting in the uptown area of Charlotte and standing in the middle of the street.
Well, how would you know they were CIA? They usually don't, you know, have, like, CIA on the back of their jacket.
They were like SUVs, dressed in suits, and they also had the earpiece in ear.
Well, that sounds like Secret Service, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were standing in the middle of the street, and they were just looking around in the uptown area of Charlotte.
Yes.
Carolina, yeah. And I'm not sure exactly what was going on.
Nor am I.
But I just wanted to go ahead and give a report of that, and I'm not sure if anybody else went ahead in the Charlotte area actually noticed what was going on in the uptown area.
All right, well, let's ask. Anybody else in Charlotte notice guys in suits with earpieces sort of wandering around in the middle of Charlotte for who knows what reason? Interesting. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is George from Fosteria, Ohio.
Yes, sir.
I saw the Taken series myself and taped it. And as an abductee, I can say that anyone who has had an experience like this should watch that movie and pay strict attention to what that little girl says clear through that show. And they'll have a better handle on what's happened to her.
Yeah, again, was that an awesome performance or what?
She's wonderful. I mean,
she absolutely knocked me down. I mean it. It was just, it was beyond the pale.
It was fabulous. I wrote you an email earlier. Maybe you didn't get it, but when I was a kid, I watched, it was either on the old Kraft Theater or the Twilight Zone about this guy that had a pill that turned water into fuel.
Yes.
And he tried to sell it to the government, demonstrated it, and emptied a tank.
I'm sure that somebody killed him, right?
No, he said he wanted $1 million for it.
That's
they
not
wouldn't
much.
Give it to him,
That's
and he completely
much.
Disappeared.
Well, there you are, see?
Well,
you know, if you really had a pill that would turn water into gasoline, you would disappear. Or you would either do one of two things, actually. You would go to work for one of the major oil companies, or you would disappear. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Mark in Atlanta calling.
Hey, Mark.
About the ball of lightning, I'm wondering if anybody's correlated this with HAARP, because if you take that type of energy and focus it on that massive scale, you're going to end up with plasma projectiles, basically. And that's kind of what I'm thinking about. This is a small scale version of it. I think the reason that HAARP is where it is because you've already got the atmosphere in a state of flux up there with plasma already. So it's just a matter of them focusing that beam, and I believe that's what they're going through that in stages. And then if they can bounce it off the troposphere, no telling what kind of damage they could do wherever it happens to land.
Well, indeed. I wonder what happens. You're certainly correct that they focus a great deal of energy using an array that's very wide at the point of RF emission and very narrow when it hits the ionosphere. I mean, very narrow. We've never done anything quite like it again. And at that point of contact, I wonder if there is something like plasma that forms. Interesting question.
Right. And I'm just thinking that what they're trying to do is find the rate of propagation so it can come down on a target. I believe that's what they're doing. Or else they're trying to make it such an RF static, if you want to call it, for lack of a better word, that any incoming ballistic missiles will lose their guidance.
Yeah, well, here's what got my attention. I was concerned all along about HAARP. But there was a recent article indicating that the scientists up in Alaska cranked HAARP up to they actually had an aurora going on over the HAARP facility. They had an aurora going on. It's fairly common in Alaska in the northern latitudes. Well, it was raging away as usual up there, or as many times it does, I guess I ought to say. And they cranked HAARP up all the way, or as high as they could at that time. And all of a sudden, the sky above them was full of little sparkly, multicolored things. I mean, it was like a light show that they were producing. All of the scientists, it is my understanding, ran out of the building and said, "Oh my God, look what we're doing." Ran out there like a bunch of children in a fireworks display to look at the effects of what they were doing with this incredible amount of RF pointed right up at the ionosphere, and there it was, sparkling away. Can you imagine? And so, yeah, I'm a little bit concerned about HAARP, and while we're on that topic, Dr. Eastland had to bow out of a recent, I don't know if I want to call it a debate with Dr. Nick Begich, but we're looking for Dr. Eastland to reconfirm. I want to do that show. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hey, Art. Boy, hey, it's great to get in touch with you again. I called you once a long time ago, back in like 97 or whatnot.
Where? 97. Where are you?
This is John from San Diego. I'm actually on my way home from the Conscious Life Expo up in Los Angeles, and I actually I saw Dr. Nick Begich today.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah, he gave a speak. I saw Daniel Brinkley today and Sean David Morton.
Okay, well, anyway, what is it you wanted to mention? We don't have a lot of time coming to the end.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you about a guest you had on many years ago, Stephen Gibbs, the man with the time machine. I was wondering if you might get him back on the air, because to be honest, that's got to be the best interview I've ever
heard.
Well,
how in the world can I get him back on the air, sir? He's gone.
Oh, he's gone?
Well, yeah, duh. He's gone. Let me quickly mention this. That young man is, to the best of my knowledge, I've not been able to locate him, Dr. David Anderson, who was an expert on time travel, is also gone. We have made numerous attempts to contact him, and he is gone. So, over the years, a number of people that I've interviewed on the subject of time travel are just gone. Now, isn't that interesting? When do you suppose they could be? Testing his theories of mass emotion in the brutal lab of reality, Bloom helped shape the careers of Prince, John Cougar Mellencamp, Bette Midler, Billy Joel, and many others. Wow. He is a visiting scholar graduate in the psychology department at New York University and a core faculty member at the Graduate Institute. He's also co-founder of the International Paleopsychology Project in the Big Bang Tango Media Lab, and in addition is a founding board member of the Epic Evolution Society and the Darwin Project. He is also a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Psychological Society, the Academy of Political Science, Human Behavior and Evolution Society, and the International for Societies, Society for Human Ethology. So he's pretty wrapped up in a lot of things. In a moment, Howard Bloom. Howard has written a couple of books, The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Expedition into the Forces of History, and Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century. Howard, welcome back to the program.
All right, it's really good to, I was going to say, see you. But it's great to see you again.
Yeah, good to have you. All right, you know, That's quite some bio that I had to read there. The Big Bang part, I would like to ask you about that. What is your view? I mean, the Big Bang is, next to the question about God, probably, and they may be intermixed, probably the biggest question for mankind right now. Any thoughts on it yourself?
Well, yes. I mean, you know the intelligent design movement.
Oh, yeah.
And you know that people in my community, the scientific community, are supposed to frown on this. And there's a good reason to frown on it, which we can go into. But there's something really spooky about this cosmos. You start, let's go to the Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang Theory, every theory in science is provisional. That means it could be replaced at any moment with something better.
Right.
Something that fits the facts better.
Right.
But this is the one that's prevailed during my lifetime. And if the Big Bang Theory is correct, you start with nothing. Absolutely nothing.
You really start with nothing?
Yes.
Now, I've heard something
nothing.
Smaller than a quark, maybe, but that's still something. You're saying nothing.
No, that's if you don't go back to before the beginning. If you go back to before the beginning, there is literally nothing.
From that
nothing,
all right.
You get something, you get a singularity. Well, you've heard of a singularity.
Yes,
something infinitely small. And from that infinitely small thing, suddenly comes rushing the biggest burst of speed you have ever seen in your life. Now, what is speed? Speed is a measure of time and space. So time, space, and speed, which we call energy, come bursting from this nothing at a speed that utterly defies belief. You go from nothing in size to humongous sizes, literally within seconds. From then, and also in the first, this is the first 10 to the minus 30 second of the cosmos. In other words, a sliver of a second so small that it doesn't even constitute a sliver of a sliver. And in that sliver of a second, from this giant unfurling sheet that has come from nowhere, there is a precipitation, like the precipitation of hailstones in a storm,
right,
of quarks. Now, Art, quarks are things. There have never been things before in this cosmos, things of no sort. That initial time-space manifold that I was talking about unfurling like a sheet, that didn't have things in it. All of a sudden, there are things. And these quarks have sociality. They need to get together in groups of three. They have this inanimate longing. It's like inanimate love or inanimate pining away for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they come together in these groups of threes, and those groups of threes make protons and neutrons. Now, Art, how in the world, implicit in nothing, is there a something of such amazing capacities? This is one of the biggest subjects in front of science.
Oh, it sure is. My answer would be that which you frown on, intelligent design. I don't see any other answers that fit. Now,
well, let me give you an answer that's not really an answer,
yeah,
okay?
Oh, well, then you're going to get political on me.
No. But the reason that intelligent design is so spookily close to the things that I believe in, without being the things I believe in, is this.
Oh.
That what you've got is the unfurling of an intelligence over the course of time. Look where we are today. It's 13.5 billion years, 13.7 billion years
right.
into the existence of the cosmos.
Right.
We have Art Bell, one intelligent human being, talking to Howard Bloom, a semi-intelligent human being.
Oh, please.
But at least between the two of us and the other 6 billion people on this planet, we have consciousness and intelligence. Well, that consciousness and intelligence was implicit in that first nothing of the Big Bang, just like that unfurling space-time sheet was, just like those first quarks were, just like those first protons and neutrons were. Now, how the hell did that happen? What you've got is an advance of this cosmos toward intelligence, and we hope toward higher degrees of intelligence. This is just the start for this universe. This is a very young universe.
Well, there's a theory out there that universes, you know, and civilizations get going and they come and go.
And they collapse. And I came up with one of those theories. You know, I got into science at the age of 10. By the time I was 16 and working in a cancer research lab, I spent a whole summer coming up with a theory of the universe. And that theory of the universe, I know this sounds nuts, that theory of the universe has played out. It predicted that at a certain point, we would go over a kind of a hump, and the universe would begin to accelerate away from itself.
Yes.
Well, that was the 1950s, Art. Guess what we discovered in 1998?
Oh, yes.
The universe is accelerating away from itself.
I know, and one day if we live long enough as a species, we will be all alone with nothing in the night sky.
No, I don't think that's going to happen, because the Bloom theory is called the Big Bagel. It's the toroidal theory of the cosmos, and it says that
the Big Bagel,
well, I'm Jewish, so of course,
okay.
A torus is a donut. And it's a bagel. And if you start from this little pinprick of nothing, and a universe of normal matter comes out of one side, the top of the bagel, and a universe of antimatter comes down on the bottom of the bagel, and the two of them eventually go over a hump, which is when the acceleration increases, and they meet each other at the bagel's edge, then you have what you were talking about, a universe that is born, reaches maturity, eventually dies and comes together in, guess what, a crunch, another one of these singularities, an infinitesimal little point from which a new universe can conceivably be born. And this kind of thing can go on over and over and over again.
Let me understand. Are you suggesting there is a contraction?
I'm suggesting that the positive universe, that's our universe, and the negative energy universe, the universe down below us, that the two of them come together in the end and annihilate each other, which is what happens when you get an antiparticle together with a normal particle, and in the process of annihilating each other produce another singularity, another little infinitesimal point from which a new universe can spring.
Well, that's as good a theory as any, I guess.
But I haven't really done anything with it in the scientific community because my work has been elsewhere. My work has been with basically taking the big picture all the way from the Big Bang up to what's going on in your brain today, my brain today, and the brains of everybody from Islamic fundamentalists to Christian fundamentalists.
I know.
All of us.
Well, again, what is it that causes you to frown on the concept, bearing in mind all you just said, of intelligent design, because you have no other explanation for it?
Well, it goes back to something that really bothered Aristotle. He called it the primo mobile problem. If you've got an all-intelligent God that produces this extraordinarily complex, extraordinarily creative universe,
yes,
then who created the creator? It must have taken, to have a high degree of intelligence like that, it must have taken a very intelligent creator to create the creator. And that's the big problem.
Well, I stop for a second and listen to this and answer this for me.
Okay.
I recently had a long talk with a Catholic priest.
Right.
Very, very nice guy.
Right.
And he said to me, Art, look all around you. Look at everything you want to look at, the blades of grass, the oxygen content in our air, the just virtually everything around you, it is so perfect.
Right.
It means there has to be intelligent design behind it all. To which I responded, Father, that would be our perception. Even if it's not creation, but evolution, it certainly would be our perception, because sure enough, we wouldn't be here unless everything was perfect.
Right. Now, here's the difficulty, and this is a big one, and this is why the Lucifer Principle, my first book is called The Lucifer Principle. Things are not perfect. You and I have both, and I hate to get into personal things, but you and I have both been through things so hideous, Art.
Yes.
That no God with any sense of decency could possibly have produced them. Not possibly. And what happened in Rwanda, you know, back in the 1980s, I was trying to get all of my friends in the media, of which I had many at that time because I was running the leading PR firm in the music industry and one of the leading firms in the PR, in the film industry. This was part of my field work. I did 20 years of field work in mass culture to discover what I needed to discover about mass behavior. I discovered that what was going on in Central Africa was a massacre, that blacks were killing each other left and right.
I know.
And
but,
tried to get my friends to cover this and stop it. And
But Howard, we got this gift of free will, so
right.
God doesn't micromanage what goes on.
But there isn't perfection in a universe with so much pain, and with our gift of free will, which we do have, whether there's a God or not, then it's our job to get rid of the pain. It's our job to get rid of the death. It's our job to get rid of the sickness. That's our job. We may not be able to do it today. We may not be able to do it tomorrow. We may not be able to do it 20 or 200 years from now. But first of all, we got to stick around. You know that nuclear weapons are going retail as we speak.
That's actually my next question, Howard. It involves Iran very much in the news right now, and it sure does look like they're actively building the bomb now.
And you know that Pakistan exploded the they called the Islamic bomb.
Yes.
The entire Islamic community in 1998.
Well, Iran building the bomb. Let's stay with that for a second.
Okay,
you're Jewish, right? So
right.
You let's see how
they
you
want
answer.
Me dead.
Let's see how you answer this question.
Right.
Who goes in there with the strike to take out their capability? Would that be the U.S. or Israel?
Well, if Israel does it, we in the West have, that is, England, the United States, and France, have callously used Israel as our point person in this for kind of thing since the war of 1957 when we sent them down to recapture the Suez Canal. So it doesn't matter whether Israel does it or the United States does it, but somebody's got to do it.
Clearly. I was just wondering, in the current political world that we live in, which do you think more likely?
I think that, speaking as a Jew, speaking as behalf of something I've been told never to tell a soul because it's the equivalent of saying you're a Nazi, I'm a Zionist. To me, a Zionist means that my job in life is to save my brethren, and my brethren are Arabs. And there are 300 million of them, and they're wasting their lives. And they're wasting their lives in violence right now. But if Israel, which has a total population, Israel has a total population one quarter the size of just one Islamic city, Cairo. It is so precarious a population, it could be wiped out with one nuclear weapon, the entire country. So I hope that Israel is not forced to do this, and I hope that the United States does it. Now, those are pretty horrific attitudes.
That would be... While I may not agree with everything you said there, I certainly think the U.S. would be more appropriately the arm of action in this case. Otherwise, you know, who knows what might happen? We might end up with a whole new Mideast war.
Well, again, if there's just one nuclear weapon exploded anywhere in Israel, there goes the entire country. The whole thing. We in America are led to believe that Israel is huge, and many of the people I've talked to in the United States believe that I've asked people, which are there more of in this world, Muslims or Jews? And people have said to me, well, they're about the same, aren't they? No, there are between 1.2 billion and 1.6 billion Muslims, depending on who's counting.
Right.
The 1.6 figure comes from a speech made by an imam just Friday. And there are fewer Jews in the world, again, than the population of Cairo, the population of just one Islamic city.
No, I've been to Israel. I have no problem agreeing
but
with
I mean,
you.
The Jews in the world are less than the population of Cairo.
Got it. And so they cannot begin to allow this to happen. And so I was just curious who you thought could more easily get away with it with less collateral damage in terms of another Mideast war.
Well, if you consider the wipeout of an entire country and a third of the population of all the Jews on the planet, collateral damage,
yes.
Then, of course, it behooves America, which has just sold a whole bunch of bunker-busting missiles, to Israel. I mean, why would we sell a whole bunch of bunker-busting missiles to Israel?
So they could destroy the nuclear facilities in Iran?
Theoretically, yes. Now, I got another question for you. Why in the world did a bunch of imams from Denmark to go traveling all over the world, starting in December, with a bunch of phony cartoons? They were not the cartoons published in the Danish newspapers. And start a massive uproar in the entire Islamic community, and it relates to what we're talking about.
To build public support?
I think it was in addition to get personal power, it was to unite the Shiite and Sunni populations, which were beginning to war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're beginning to war with each other in Iraq. The reason now why, if Pakistan, which very self-consciously went after getting a nuclear weapon in 1992, and called it for the Islamic bomb 6 years before it ever exploded its first bomb. If this is the Islamic bomb to be shared by the entire Islamic community worldwide, why doesn't Iran have a nuclear weapon yet? Do you have any idea? Why haven't they given it to Iran?
I don't know.
Because Iran is Shiite. And do you know what Sunnis think of Shiites?
Not much.
Well, do you know what a kafir is?
No.
A kafir is an unbeliever. And in the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the most important interpreter of the Quran of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
a kafir, an unbeliever, is as impure as urine or feces
mm-hmm.
or even dog feces.
Mm-hmm.
That includes you and it includes me. We're kafirs.
I understand.
Okay, the Sunni population, much of it looks at the Shiite population as kafirs, as impure as dogs, wine, and urine. That's why the Sunni population of Pakistan would not give the bomb to the Shiites of Iran.
Okay.
Now, if you've got a split that big in your community, and it's getting worse every day, and you can reunite it again around a cartoon, you can take a bunch of pictures the Danes never, ever published, using pig heads with turbans on their heads. These pictures are disgusting. When I see them, I'm disgusted by them. And I'm for freedom of speech to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm.
They are absolutely disgusting. These are not the Danish cartoons. These are phonies.
Well, from our point of view, Howard, I suspect we would like to see them disrupted, fighting with each other, as opposed to united against us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as a consequence, when a statement came from Ayman al-Zawahiri, I think it is, the left-hand man to Osama bin Laden, a statement came out of him 5 months ago that was released by the Defense Department in the United States, and it said it was to the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and it said to him, stop fighting the Shiites. We need unity between ourselves. Yes, you can pull a genocide on the Shiites later on.
Has there been religious permission to use an atomic weapon against?
Oh yes. Imams have said, as a matter of fact, that it is absolutely required by God that Islam make nuclear weapons.
Here's a question I want to ask. Howard, it's clear that there are people in the world that want us dead.
Yes.
They want us dead. We're non-believers. We need to die.
Right.
Now, my question is this. What we don't get in the U.S. media, in my opinion, is an honest assessment of how widespread that feeling is in parts of the Islamic world. In other words, how truly widespread is it? In the American press, you just sort of get a sense, because it's a sense the president wants us to have, that it's just a small segment.
Yep, and that's the sense that the American press wants to believe in itself and wants you to believe in, too. One of my Islamic friends was over here. I mean, we're talking from a bedroom. We've been talking from a bedroom together for the last God knows how many years. Because, you know, I was stuck in a bed with an illness for 14 years.
Right.
And one of my Islamic friends was over here, and I said, look, if only 10% of the Muslim population of the world is militant or pro-militant, that's 120 million people, which is more than the population of France, Germany, and England combined
mm-hmm.
in the Second World War.
Is it that high?
He said, you're wrong about that 10%. And I thought he was going to tell me it's 5% or it's 2%. Do you know what he said? He said it's 70% at least. This is an Islamic friend in the Islamic community.
Okay, well, that's a opinion.
That's one opinion from one friend in the Islamic community. I have another friend in the Islamic community who is an atheist and doesn't dare tell his family. You could die for being an atheist in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And his impression is the same. Almost everybody he meets, including, because he's from America, he's only spending a year in Pakistan with his family. And even here in the American community, that's his impression. The first friend that I was talking about said, you should have seen it in my community, meaning his Arab community, Islamic community, Islamic American community of upper middle class professionals.
Mm-hmm.
You should have seen it in my community the day after 9/11, he said. People were rejoicing.
Yeah, I've heard these stories.
And this is from an Islamic friend. Now, I look for Islamic moderates because, again, as a Zionist, these Arabs in particular are the closest genetic cousins I've got on the face of the planet. And I think they've got tremendous amounts of ingenuity.
All right. Here's another question for you, Howard. We have been conducting a war on terrorism now for some time, very actively, of course, since 9/11.
Right.
What would your assessment be of how much damage we've done to these jerks?
I think we've done a substantial amount of damage. I think the fact that the United States hasn't been touched since 9/11
is proof,
a miracle.
Is proof of that?
I think that whoever has pulled that off, and of course we don't know who pulled it off, but whoever has pulled that off is doing a brilliant job of something.
I kind of have the same assessment, that we really have severely damaged them.
Because these are very bright people. They use tremendous amounts of creativity in their violence. They have no compunctions about wiping out populations, and they've been limited to a bus attack and subway attack in London, to a horrible, horrible train attack in Spain, but no attacks on the greatest Satan of them all.
Yes.
You know how many attacks they've had on Russia since 9/11? It's been attack after attack after attack after attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they are known for greater toughness, military toughness, than
we
are.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
So I think that we've had a major impact. But remember, this is the longest-lasting world war in the history of this globe. It's a war that's been going on for 1,400 years. We're the kind of supremacy that the West has, it's only had for at most 200 years. I mean, the last... let me do it from a different point of view. I'm just finishing the 10th anniversary edition of The Lucifer Principle. The Lucifer Principle is credited as the book that predicted 9/11. I felt I owed my audience a history of Islam. It has taken years to get this together, decades to get this together, because it's such a fragmented history. But what you come up with when you finish putting the pieces together is that within 100 years of Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire was 5 times the size of the Roman Empire and 7 times the size of the United States. And it has been fighting Dar el-Harb, the abode or the land of the unbeliever, which also literally means the abode or the land of war, ever since Muhammad's death in 632 A.D. That's a long, long, long world war.
Sure.
So we have damaged the warriors for the moment. But Islam knows something we don't. It has a wisdom we don't have. It is willing to participate in multi-generational projects, projects that could take 700 years to come to completion. We are obsessed with quarterly profits and exit strategies.
Yeah.
When I hear the words exit strategy for Iraq, I get furious because the people behind it don't understand the nature of this world. And they don't understand the nature of our opponents. And they don't even understand the nature of our own civilization, which has pulled off brilliant multi-generational projects that have made us, you and me, so rich in powers. Everything from Alexander Graham Bell's the telephone,
mm-hmm.
which was based on 300 years of research into electronics, that has now evolved into the cell phones that have changed our lives. Again, that electrical revolution that started with research into electricity in approximately 1650, that's a long time ago, now sits in a laptop computer on my lap. That's a multi-generational project.
Yes.
We do brilliant multi-generational projects. It's time for us to wake up and realize that we do them, and it's time for people who run companies like Enron to realize that they are running a company, which if it's not in the multi-generational game, they don't belong at the head of that company. If it's not a company they want to see as the company of the next 50 years and the next 50 years of American history and the next 50 years of Western history and the next 50 years of the history of mankind, they don't belong in a CEO position.
All right. I would imagine there's a gigantic effort to lay hands on a bomb. It's just got to be monstrous. Now,
oh, yes.
Knowing what you know about what may be loose in the old Soviet Union, what technology may be for sale, and or what bombs may be for sale, if you had to make a guess about when the next atomic weapon will be used in anger by anybody, how long do you think that might be?
1.5 to 3 years or less. It could be as short as 2 months.
Oh, my God.
We have a very, very tiny window of opportunity here.
Could be as short as 2 months.
Yes.
And what would you imagine the target to be? Tel Aviv? New York.
New York City.
New York.
Yes. But they've named the targets.
Always
New York and Washington are the two primary targets.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
And you know the story of the nuclear subs. I've talked about them on the show, but not with you, with George.
No, you've talked to me about them.
Okay. And so these nuclear subs carry 18 missiles apiece. All of those missiles are nuclear. And they can reach 65% of the American population. So if the Osama fans, if the militants were to get their hands on these two submarines, and one of the most unhinged cities in the world is Karachi, which is where these submarines are based,
mm-hmm.
Then they could take out Houston, which would take out all of our fuel capacity. They could take out L.A. just for symbolic significance. They could take out New York. They could take out Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, all at once. And you take those cities out, and that's the end of America.
What do you think would be the U.S. response, to that sort of an attack?
Well,
I mean, when the first city was hit, Howard,
right.
We would respond.
We would respond, but we'd have a hard choice of picking a target. If these submarines come from Pakistan, and Pakistan is our closest ally, what do? Nuke Pakistan, which has one of the biggest Islamic populations in the world? When we're in fact dealing with an enemy that's living in Hamburg in Germany, that's living in New York City in Brooklyn, which is living in Detroit, and which is living all over the world,
but
who do we take out?
You would begin by taking out the submarines that fired the missiles. Certainly we would know where those submarines would be.
We would not know where they are. They are super stealth subs.
Once they fired those missiles, we'd know exactly where they are.
We might have an idea.
Yes, and we would take them out with nukes. That would be starters.
Well, we couldn't do that. Because these would be off our shores, and we would be hitting ourselves.
All right. It is my understanding that nuclear weapons have a distinct signature. In other words, that our scientists would be able to determine where they were manufactured.
Right.
Okay. So it seems to me you hit whoever made them.
Okay. Now think of this. You are an Islamic warrior. Everybody who is martyred goes directly to paradise.
Right.
If all of Pakistan is martyred, they all go directly to paradise. What percentage are they of the total worldwide Islamic population? A very small percent. One of the things that Osama says in his speeches, you know I have a file of all of Osama's speeches, and I go over them regularly.
Yes.
And one of the things that he says in his speeches is, you are cowards. You only have one or two children each. When you lose one in the streets of Somalia and he's dragged through the streets, you cowards, you withdraw. You withdraw. We don't. I can have 12 sons. My father had 70 sons. Osama's father had 70 kids. I can be proud of losing 10 of those kids because all of them have gone to paradise warring in the way of God, which is the phrase that is used.
Well,
Which means I can afford to let you take Pakistan. To you, it's a nightmare. To me, it's paradise.
All right, Howard, how do we fight that?
It is very difficult, Art, and I can't. First of all, we fight it with knowledge. Secondly, we fight it by knowing that multi-generational strategies count. Third, we fight it. I'm writing a book. You probably know about this. It's available online at howardbloom.net in draft form called Reinventing Capitalism, Putting Soul in the Machine, A Radical Reperception of Western Civilization. We understand why this civilization we live in is worthy of more idealistic commitment than any civilization that has ever existed on the face of the earth. Why this is the only civilization that's done what every major idealistic system promises, which is to raise the poor and the oppressed. We have done it in ways that are absolutely astonishing. A poor person in the United States has a television set, for God's sakes,
well,
has a radio.
Howard, we're winning. Democracy, capitalism is winning. The only way the tables get turned is by something incredible like the use of perhaps multiple nuclear weapons. I don't know. Otherwise, if you look around the world right now, really, we're winning by default.
Well, about 6 months ago, I noticed I watched the Arab news every night, and I watched something very strange unfolding in Arab news, that instead of the usual shoot the dictator and have a coup d'etat form of governmental change that has dominated in the Middle East during most of our lifetimes,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden there were protests, very much like the civil rights protests of the 1960s, taking place in Iran, taking place in Syria. I mean, Syria, you go out on the street and dare to protest, you just signed a death sentence for
yourself. Yeah, I mean, freedom, it's spreading like a virus.
And the language of freedom, the language of democracy as we know it, is being used all of a sudden in the last 4 to 6 months on Islamic TV news, every single night. Transparency, accountability, these are words that are showing up in the Islamic press, the TV news, every single night. And I wrote to a bunch of friends of mine. I wrote to a friend in the State Department. I wrote to a friend in the intelligence community. I wrote to a friend who's a managing editor of a huge publishing operation in Dubai. I wrote to a friend who is responsible for helping negotiate the end to the apartheid problem in South Africa and has just come from making incredible progress in the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Don Beck is his name. He's the Spiral Dynamics Movement. I wrote to all of these friends and to a friend who was the founder of the who's a Muslim, who is the former education minister for Malaysia, who's a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and the founder of the two leading journals of Islamic studies in the Islamic world. And I said, I see a velvet revolution unfolding here in the Middle East.
No question.
Am I crazy?
No, you're not. I'm saying the same. It's true. It's happening now.
Well, they all agreed with you, Art.
So if you're in that group of people that hates our guts right now, what you're perceiving is that we are winning, and so you're beginning to get to be very desperate.
And there's another reason to circulate the phony Danish cartoons. And that's another reason to use the nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Desperate people, desperate things, that sort of thing. I can clearly see that, you know, it's encroaching on them from all directions.
Absolutely. And they know it. And they, first of all, they feel we're about to topple. Secondly, they feel that is pollution on Earth. When they talk about tyranny, the word tyranny is used very, very often in the Islamic community, but it doesn't mean tyranny in the way that we think of tyranny. Tyranny means any form of government which is not run according to Sharia,
mm-hmm.
at least in the vocabulary of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranians. That's what it means. There's the Ayatollah Khomeini talked over and over again about any force that threatens corruption on Earth must be eliminated, which means our people, that means the Muslims, have been forced to eliminate many a tribe in order to stop corruption. Do you know what corruption is?
Yes.
Corruption is simply seeing an American movie.
Yes. Yes, I'm aware.
It's simply allowing an influence of the language, like the language of elections and constitutions and transparency and accountability, to penetrate the Islamic world. That's corruption on Earth. That has to be wiped out by the most violent means possible.
And that would be the atomic bomb. And you're thinking from 2 months forward a little bit, one's going to be used really that soon.
Right. With a specific strategy. Wipe out the United States and make England, France, and Germany, and Italy give up to you. Because Europe has been promised to Islam ever since the beginning. Ever since Muhammad's day.
All right. Well, we've been doing a pretty good job so far. As you pointed out, there have been no major attacks since 9/11 on U.S. soil.
That's an astonishing job.
Yes, indeed. So what are the odds of our interdicting any effort to do what you're talking about right now and or not?
Art, it's very hard to say because so many things are classified. There are good things about this administration and bad things about this administration. And one is that so many things are classified for good reason right now, so that the enemy can't follow our moves, that it's very hard for you and me to know what we're doing and what we're not doing.
Well, right. That's mostly good, I would think. You don't let the enemy know what you're doing.
So as a consequence, you and I are not in a position to really guess.
Well, let me nevertheless ask you for one. If left to their own devices, good word, and nothing is done, how soon will Iran have a bomb?
Oh, my God. My fear is that Iran already has it. Now, remember, I mean, we've only got a few minutes before the break, but remember that Germany convinced the world that it was dedicated, utterly dedicated to peace in the 1920s.
Yes.
And it convinced the world so thoroughly that a guy named Stresemann, who was a major figure in the German government who negotiated peace treaties with the West, with the rest of us, won a Nobel Peace Prize. Do you know what they were doing the whole time that he was negotiating this stuff? It was all phony.
Getting ready for war.
That's right. And you know where they were doing it? They weren't allowed to have any military facilities in their own country. So they were doing it in the Ural Mountains in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you can be very sneaky in the development of your weapons. The West had no idea, the West, by that I mean the Allies, had no idea the Germans were bulking up their military capacities. None. Or they wouldn't have given out that Nobel Peace Prize.
And you feel the same kind of effort is underway with regard to nuclear devices right now. And Annie, these are fast blasts I'm getting. Annie from Idaho says, hey, Art, if we are hit by the fundamentalists with a nuke, perhaps prior to that occurring, we should warn those people that whoever it might be, sort of in a general warning that the response would be taking out Mecca and Medina. Howard, have we served up privately back channel any such warnings?
You know, that's a really tricky one.
I specialize in tricky ones.
Right. Well, I think it's a good idea because Mecca and Medina are very, very important. There are a lot of people who would believe that God would not let that happen one way or the other. Let me say something about the warmongering accusation and the accusation about nuclear war polluting the planet to the point where no life could exist. In 1936, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made a speech in Chicago saying it's time to put a halt to the violence of the Japanese in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
What were the Japanese doing? They had taken over Mongolia. They had then invaded China.
Yeah.
In the rape of Nanking alone, they killed 367,000 people, raping as they went. And at that point, FDR said, enough. It is time for us to stand up against this violence. That was 1936. Do you know what the newspapers shouted him down for and the public?
Warmongering.
That's exactly it. Now, if we had taken on Germany and Japan in 1936, we would have saved 40 million lives because Germany at that point wasn't strong enough to stand up to us. Because of our newspapers, because of people who claimed that FDR was a warmonger, they gave the Germans an extra 3 years in which to arm themselves, and the result was 40 million deaths. So who were the warmongers?
Well, there was a time when America never hit back until we were hit, even if we had to make it up, you know.
Right, and that unfortunately that time has passed. We're an international power, and the human race is at stake here. Because, again, when it comes to polluting the planet, as far as the militant Muslims are concerned, this planet, and I'm quoting, is but a speck of dust in the eye of God. It
right.
doesn't matter. Number two,
right.
because Allah is going to protect the faithful, all that fallout stuff, that won't happen.
If the audience listening to you right now finds that they're doubting what you say about the belief systems, because after all, the belief systems dictate what somebody ultimately would be willing to do. And so it all really hangs on that. If they want to learn more about the belief systems you're describing and verify for themselves that this is the psychology at play, what would you recommend they read?
Go read The Lucifer Principle. It'll give you a lot of clues. It'll give you a lot of information. Then read the Quran.
Yeah, that's where I wanted you to go. I noticed you got your book in there first, ahead of the Quran.
Right. Well, you know, the Quran's a better seller than mine. It doesn't need the help. But, literally, you can get the Quran in English translation all over the Internet. So please, just sit down and read the Quran. Or do something better. Do a search for the word fire. One of my Islamic friends came over here one night, and he had been having a fight with another friend who obviously doesn't read the Quran, but listens to his imam every Friday, and said that his friend said that fire never appears in the Quran. Well, fire appears over and over again, and it's fire that is so premonitory, it's so prescient about nuclear fire, that it's ridiculous. Fire is the ultimate punishment. The ultimate punishment.
What are you doing in New York, anyway?
What am I doing in New York? Art, if there's a trouble point that's in danger and I want to defend it, that's where I'm going to be. That's just a personal statement.
And what exactly are you going to do when the detonation occurs? What are you going to rush out and defend?
I'm not going to be able to defend a thing, Art. I'm defending with all of my intellectual skills or all of my communicative skills or all of my research skills. I'm doing my best to wake up America. I was told, and I'm not sure whether it's true or not, that Ian Punnett about 8 months ago went on the air and said that Howard Bloom is the Paul Revere of America. Somebody's got to Paul Revere us, and it can't just be me. It's got to be a bunch of us.
Well, what it's going to require is the kind of understanding we were talking about a few moments ago. Reading the Quran, for example, understanding our enemy is key to acting appropriately.
And, you know, there are books coming out right now. Don't read Peter Bergen's book about Osama, because Peter Bergen, unfortunately, who is one of the experts on Osama and should know better, doesn't seem to have a clue. He has not studied Islamic history at all. He's ignorant. But there are authors right now who are bringing out books of Osama's speeches. Now, this is the problem with Osama's speeches. They, in the same way that if I were to say to you, I believe in, or Art, certainly you believe in the Constitution and in the principles of Thomas Jefferson, don't you?
Can you give me a rundown, he says, averting that one, can you give me a rundown of Osama's last two delivered speeches, he said? I mean, they're very recent.
Well, okay, the most recent, because the second most recent gets mixed in with all the others in my mind. But the most recent, he said, we're not finished with you yet. We have more attacks coming. You just haven't seen them. They're in preparation stages. However, we're offering you a truce. If you stop fighting us and pull all of your troops out of the Middle East, we'll stop fighting you.
That's what I wanted. To the average person, that sounds like a cave. It sounds like he's caving in.
Well, but it's the opposite. Because the tradition of Islam, first of all, the guy who started the militant tradition in Islam is Muhammad. In 9 years, Muhammad was the commander of 65 military expeditions. He personally led 27 of them. He, to use the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini, he killed and was killed. I mean, he was willing to be killed.
But, I mean, since when do you make a deal with the devil?
The problem is that the word truce in Islamic history, where war is considered to never stop, war between the unbeliever and the believers never stops. Mm. And I'm talking about mainstream Islam. A truce is a temporary period in which you build up your own strength so you can overcome the enemy.
So you think the request for a truce probably reflects how badly we've clobbered their butts recently?
Not really. It says, you stay calm and think that I'm not doing anything against you, and I will build up my forces so that you will never recover from the next move.
You've got to admit it was odd, though.
The last statement?
The thing about the truce, or even offering
it. Makes two kinds. It's not the first time he's offered us a truce. He offered a truce about a year ago to Europe, And he said, if you guys just abandon America and pull all your troops out, no more of these attacks like the one in Spain and England will happen.
Yeah, that's more like an ultimatum.
Well, yes, but then a guy who started this ultimatum thing was named Mohammed. And he sent letters out to the six biggest emperors of his day. And he basically said, I am inviting you to Islam. Doesn't that sound pleasant? Doesn't that sound nice?
Yeah.
I'm inviting you to Islam. But if you do not accept my invitation, you will be sinners.
Right.
And you will be sinners against your people. And then, in the 10th anniversary edition of Lucifer and Soul, which probably won't be out for 6 or 7 months, I tell you exactly what all the Quran says happens to sinners. And believe me, Art, it's not nice.
All right. Your comments on the war. Now, I know that you got very upset at even the mention of a troop pullout or an exit strategy or anything that would suggest even that we're going to let up or pull out or get our butts out of there. And I understand that.
Right.
I really do understand that. But let me ask you honestly, as we prosecute what we're doing in Iraq right now, do you think that we're making more enemies? Isn't it possible that we're actually creating our own enemies as we continue?
Yes, absolutely. There are a lot of people who are going to hate us for what's going on in Iraq, and there are a lot of things that I hate about what's going on in Iraq. Every civilian casualty, knocking people's doors down, burning their houses out.
You bet.
These are unacceptable things.
Yes.
But again, Art, we live in a world where if there is a God, he has been doing unacceptable things through us for a long, long time, and not just through us, through all of animal kind.
But so on balance, you feel that the damage we're doing, the war we're prosecuting is more important than the enemies we're creating.
Well, you know that Iran is not really run by its president.
Right.
It is run by its
run by their
religion.
Yeah, the Iran.
Right. And the religious head of Iran, the guy who really runs the place, gave a speech 2 weeks ago, and he basically said, see those cowards, the Americans, they're talking of pulling out. We've won. We've won.
Yeah.
We've won. And that's exactly what Osama has been saying for years. He has been saying, see, in Somalia, we dragged one body through the street, they pulled out, we won.
Mm-hmm.
Those cowards, it takes nothing to make them run.
Mm-hmm.
It takes nothing to make them run. So which is the greater act of warmongering, to stay in Iraq or to flee, given the way that the Islamic world interprets our fleeing?
I don't disagree. I wasn't particularly fond when we went into Iraq. I didn't think it was necessarily a wise idea, particularly to be an occupying force. But we are there now, and I don't want to see another Vietnam-like finish.
Well, I don't either, by any stretch of the imagination. And with these particular people dealing with Islam, again, this is the biggest imperialistic force the world has ever seen.
So in your opinion, we will be in Iraq how long?
If we have to stay in Iraq for 60 or 70 years, then so be it. Because Islam measures things in multi-generational terms.
You made that clear, yes. So you really think that, and do you in fact think that we will be able to politically pull that off? That's a separate question.
Well, now here's, okay, George Bush, I always wondered about Iraq, and I can tell you an Iranian conspiracy theory, if you'd like to hear it, and it's a very interesting one, and the only one that makes sense to me.
Sure.
About how the Iranians manipulated us into starting this war with Iraq.
Sure.
But before, well, okay, we'll go directly into that. The Guardian, I believe it was, in England, came out with a story and then never followed up on it. And it said this. Now, were you at all puzzled when Chalabi, who is our man in Iraq,
oh, yes,
was all of a sudden overnight
discredited?
Discredited?
Yeah.
And did you wonder why in the world that strange thing had happened?
Are you suggesting that that Iran was behind the whole damn thing?
Yes. Because how the Guardian story went.
Yeah.
Chalabi spent 25 years building up his contacts in the White House, in the State Department, in the Department of Defense,
right,
and in Congress. 25 years, that's a lot of contacts you can make if you're very good, and he was very good at that. The Iranians and he, the Iranian Secret Service, or the Iranian CIA, has had a very close relationship with him for a long time. Now, think of you're running Iran right now. Put yourself in Iran's position. You were forced to go to war with Iraq, and you welcomed the war in a sense because you wanted to demonstrate that you could put religious leaders like yours in top positions in countries all over the world. And this was your opportunity to topple that horrible, satanic, secular leader,
mm-hmm.
Saddam Hussein. So you spent 8 years and a million lives facing down Saddam Hussein, making war with Saddam Hussein, and you couldn't win.
Right.
You weren't able to win. Now let's come up with a strategy that doesn't cost us anything. Why don't we, as Iranians, phony up a bunch of documents that show exactly where all of the weapons of mass destruction are located in Iraq? Now, why don't we give them to Chalabi and claim that they are legitimate documents so that even Chalabi thinks that he's coming to the State Department and he's coming to the Department of Defense with legitimate intelligence?
Got it.
And there you've got it from there. Now, who's running Iraq these days? Do you have any idea?
I guess it's kind of a split deal, really, right?
Well, no, not really. There was only one political party when Saddam was in power.
I'm referring to our presence. In other words, we're part of it.
Yeah. Well, basically, the situation is that we may be running part of it, but there was only one political party that Saddam Hussein couldn't touch. He destroyed every other form of organization that might possibly interfere with him or might possibly challenge him. But he could not destroy the Friday sermons given at the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And those basically kept a party together for all practical purposes. They were the only form of organization left in that country. Now, guess who controls those? It's a Shiite-dominated country.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of the Shiite group in Iraq comes from what country? Iran.
Right. Right.
So the Iranians were positioned in a democratic process to take over the whole country because they had the only functional party.
So Chalabi was their puppet.
Chalabi was apparently their puppet, yes. Now, you won't read this anyplace else.
No.
I'm not going to bother to rewrite it up in my book because it's not going to be relevant 10 years from now, and I'd like my books to be around for 10 to 15 or 20 years.
I sure would like some other verification of that. I mean, I can see, certainly in retrospect, that you could put that together in your head, and it makes an awful lot of sense.
Right.
But it sure would be fun to have additional verification.
Well, one of the difficulties with our press is that it has become so passive and so lazy that it doesn't follow up on things like this. So that one story appeared, it was never followed up even to refute it. Now, if that isn't derogation of duty, abandonment of duty on the part of a press that's supposed to be our protector and defender, then nothing is. Even the blogs haven't been covering this, Art.
So what do you have to support it beyond the fact that it's a pretty damn intriguing theory?
I have absolutely nothing. I was sent to me by a friend who is a writer at CNN, and I wrote him immediately back saying this is the only thing that I have read that answers the question, why Iraq?
Why we were so embarrassed, why the British were so embarrassed, why there was so much bad information.
Yeah, I mean, the only other explanation is that Iraq was the weakest point and the easiest thing to pick on. But Tony Blair is not a man who lies. I cannot say that about George Bush. If George Bush says he's about to go big time on a program, that means that tomorrow he's going to pull the budget from that program. He's not an honest man. But Tony Blair is a man of integrity, or that's my impression. And Tony Blair literally went in front of Parliament saying, I have documents that prove that Iraq could be hitting us with weapons of mass destruction within 48 hours.
I'm well aware.
Now, why would Tony Blair say such a thing if he didn't have such documents? And
well,
who would have fed it to him?
Because he did have them.
Yes, and who would have fed it to him?
Us.
And where would we have gotten them?
Well, maybe from Chalabi. Given an opportunity to type a message, they're very uninhibited. There's something about that. And David from Fort Lauderdale, Florida says, hey, Art, You have a keen mind and sense of humor. You are promoting war, and because you are intelligent, I must assume that you therefore have sold out to the people who are in charge of this once honest nation. I'm saddened that we have lost you. David, that's a really interesting comment, and I wish you were here so we could have a little bit of a debate. What I would say to you is this. Yes, America once had the luxury of waiting until she was hit directly before she responded. We had that luxury because oceans were big, not easy to necessarily cross, and attack another nation. So we had the luxury of waiting till we got hit. We don't have that anymore, David. And I guess I would ask this. If you knew that a man, any man, had stated an intention to kill you and your family, and you saw this man essentially running up your driveway with a loaded shotgun, David, would you wait until he pulled the trigger, or would you grab a gun yourself and try and preempt him? What would you do, David? You know, actually, my little story about the guy running up the driveway with a shotgun loaded and ready was insufficient, because he had not just stated that he would kill your family and kill you, David. But in the case of the people who want us dead, they've already more or less demonstrated with 9/11 what they are willing to do. So we already have seen an act of violence on their part, of mass violence. And do you honestly think, David, that they would not, given the opportunity, explode a nuclear device either in Tel Aviv or in New York City or whatever? How would you respond to that, Howard?
I think, Art, that your statement was, I hate to say this because it sounds too good to be true. I think it was absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
And to take it another step further, if that man running up your driveway shoots your wife, are you an accomplice in that murder? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, saw him coming, you knew what he was going to do. If you stood by and did nothing, then yes.
Yeah. And that means that when the United States told Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, shut up about this stuff already, you're a warmonger, those people who said that were the accomplices in 40 million deaths. When I went to television producers and to publishers in the 1980s, asking them to cover the Hutus and the Tutsis, and none of them would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, in my mind, became accomplices in the deaths of a million Hutus and Tutsis.
And then there was Cambodia.
Peace groups have a consistent, and look, I started marching in peace marches when I was a teenager in the 1950s, banning the bomb. I was marching against the war in Vietnam, in Washington, over and over again. I do not like war, and that's a vast understatement. But as long as there are people on this planet who do, those of us who don't, when we see violence about to happen, when we avert our eyes, we are accomplices in the deaths. And those deaths, in the case of World War I and World War II, were deaths in the 40 million range. And believe me, when nuclear weapons come into use, those deaths will be in the billions. And we, all of us, who shut our eyes, will be accomplices, possibly, in the destruction of all of humanity and possibly even of all multicellular life. We will never kill off bacteria. They are so much better at us that research or development and creativity that it's ridiculous.
All right. Since we've come to that, I have not yet asked you one question that relates to what tonight's show
was
supposed to be about.
My wife came up and said, all of those people who are listening for this revolution in energy, the next alternative energy step, are going to murder you.
Yeah, that's right. So let's rock. What have you got?
Well, first of all, there's one group that we didn't mention when you were going over the intro of all the groups I belong to. This is one I'm particularly proud of.
I can only read what I've got.
Right. It's called the Aerospace Technologies Working Group.
Okay.
And it's a group that was founded in 1989 by NASA. And to do major coordinations between disparate things, It's been headed by a guy named Ken Cox ever since then. Ken Cox, it was with the Apollo program, was instrumental in bringing Apollo 13 back to Earth safe after one of its canisters blew up. It includes people like Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, who was Apollo 14's lunar module pilot, the guy who ran Mission Control Center in Houston, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I've interviewed Ed many times.
Right. So they were kind enough to make me a part of their group about 4 months ago. One of the members of the group, who's been a friend for a couple of years, is a major program director at NSF. His name is Paul Werbos. And Paul has been trying to tell me for the last 2 years that the answer to our energy problems were methanol and ethanol. And I did not believe him. And then I discovered 2 months ago or so that there are 5 million cars capable of operating. Ethanol and methanol are biofuels.
Yes, I know.
And there are 5 million cars capable of operating on biofuels on the road in America today.
As opposed to how many otherwise?
Well, that's a very good question. And I don't have, I'm seriously embarrassed. I don't have the answer to that question.
Well, the answer to that question is seriously a large number. In other words, what I'm getting at is ethanol and methanol are indeed, it's a good highway to travel. But frankly, Howard, I've been told by people who claim they know
right.
that it would still be a tiny, tiny a change.
No, not at all.
Numerically.
Because Brazil, which started on this path in the 1980s,
yes.
40% of its transport sector is now running on biofuels. 75% of its cars, thanks to this new thing called flex fuel vehicles.
Flex fuel. Okay. In other words, you can use either one.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right.
Gasoline if you can't find ethanol or methanol.
Right.
75% of its cars are now flex fuel vehicles. Do you know what the two major companies producing flex fuel vehicles are and what the inventor is one of them? They're American companies that we think are dead and tottering on their feet, General Motors and Ford.
They are having difficulties. I mean,
having severe difficulties, yeah. But what one of the things that you learn in history, and again, this goes back to stuff you can read about in the Lucifer Principle, the countries that are at the forefront of new technology revolutions are the countries that dominate for the next 50 to 60 years. And new technology revolutions are usually based on new energy revolutions. There was the wood revolution, the wind revolution, the water revolution, the coal revolution, and now the oil revolution. And now it's time for the next revolution. It's already taking place in Brazil, but it's taking place because of two automakers, GM and Ford. Ford invented the flex fuel vehicle. It started to develop it in the 1980s. It brought it to a point of perfection 3 years ago, such that, according to a Fortune magazine article from 2 weeks ago, flex fuel vehicles are selling like iPods in Brazil.
All right. Well, earlier in the program, you took the opportunity to lay one on George Bush. You know, I believe you called him a liar.
Right.
I would take it that your view on why Brazil has lots of flex vehicles and we have very few leads right up to the top, yes?
Well, not necessarily. I don't think there's necessarily a conspiratorial thing going on here, but
I didn't say that.
When the guy said that we're addicted to oil.
Yeah, I didn't say that. I said just that it leads to the top. In other words, President Bush is regarded, I think, reasonably as an oil man.
He's an oil president, and this is an oil presidency.
Yeah.
And Dick Cheney and all the boys are in the oil business.
Yeah.
But the simple fact of the matter is somebody does a wonderful job of writing Bush's speeches, and there are an awful lot of truths in those speeches. And one of them was back in February when I was wondering why in the world we'd go into Iraq, and he said it was because he felt that the Middle East was anxious for democracy.
Uh-huh.
And then, as I told you, I discovered what seemed to be a velvet revolution taking place in the Middle East and was astonished because only George Bush's speeches had predicted this. And in the Middle East, George Bush was being credited. I mean, everybody was saying this is not happening because of George Bush's speeches. What does that tell you? That they were all aware of George Bush's speeches. But back to this alternative revolution. This thing is ready to go. There are 73 companies in the United States producing biofuels. There are 93 plants in the United States producing biofuels. There are 3.67 billion gallons a year of biofuels being produced. And we have barely gotten started. We we haven't gotten started for all practical purposes. The 5 million flex-fuel vehicles, biofuel-capable vehicles, on the roads in America today, their owners don't even know they've got biofuel vehicles. They don't even know they're driving the vehicles of the future. Back to what happens in history, that country that dominates the coming technology is the country that becomes dominant in the world. And today we are looking backwards. We are looking back as if our heyday was the 1960s and 1970s when we had men on the moon. I'm sorry, our future is the future. Our future is in these alternative fuels. And what I came up with my collaborators from NSF and from NASA, with the Aerospace Technologies and Working Group, is a very, very simple plan. And it's first, we go to biofuels, which we're all set for. GM and Ford are cranking these things out left and right. The next step is we go to plug-in hybrids capable of operating on biofuels. And the next step is that we put up space solar arrays in space. And this is what my friend Paul Verbos at NSF has been funding all the research for for years. We put up solar array after solar array after solar array, not using our old clunky billion-dollar throwaway tin cans of rockets, but using a space plane that Paul and a person named Ray Chase have developed that takes off from Vandenberg Air Force Base, lands, takes off again and lands, and we put up as many of these things as possible. Then they all have their own propulsion systems, all of these solar arrays. They all operate with a robotic intelligence. All this stuff has been funded by Paul Verbos, in other words, by NSF.
Have you looked at all into, this is a very fascinating area for me. It goes back to my reading of Sunstroke. I wonder if you remember that book.
No, I wasn't.
Oh, you don't remember Sunstroke? Okay,
no, good. Tell me.
I'll lay the scenario on you. Well, of course, what you're talking about is putting up collection units in space and then essentially microwaving the power back to...
Right, or a light-to-light laser.
To the ground, but probably microwave. It would probably be the most efficient right now.
Right.
And there are some concerns and worries about that process and about putting that energy through the various levels of atmosphere that we have.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I have been tremendously concerned about this ever since Paul educated me on the energy from space alternative. Very concerned about it. I've said, what if a bird flies through it? What if a plane flies through it? What if a pebble hits this giant solar array?
What if the satellite? What if the satellite drifts?
Yeah,
that was Sunstroke. It drifted and began frying everything in its path.
Right. Now, all I can tell you is what Paul tells me, because we had this conversation on Friday, preparing for this show.
Yes.
And I haven't had a chance to go check it out, triple check it, and do the stuff I usually do. But what Paul says is we have the two alternatives. One is a light-to-light laser. The other is a microwave laser. Mm-hmm. Paul has funded the research on these lasers. That is, NSF has funded the research. And Paul says that the technology has been checked, double-checked, and triple-checked, and is absolutely safe. And I hate, Paul is probably listening, and so are probably all of the guys in the Aerospace Technologies Working Group who are very interested in this program, but if they didn't turn off in our first hour and a half because of our warmongering. But I hate to say this in front of Paul's listening ears. I won't believe it until I have triple-checked it.
Well, that has kind of the ring of nothing can go wrong.
Yes. We've heard that many a time, haven't we?
We have.
But the major thing is that the biofuels thing is upon us. It's a tidal wave. It's going to happen whether people like me get involved or
well,
or
all
we
of these things that you're talking about are certainly things that we can move forward on if and when we get the political backbone to do it. Now,
Well, there is a bill making its way through Congress. It's at the very early stage. It was introduced in November. I can never remember its name. It's something like the Energy Technologies and Freedom and Self-Defense Bill or something like that.
Yeah.
I'll get the name for you in a minute.
These things are frequently strangled right in their cribs.
Well, but it's got both Republican and Democratic support.
Encouraging.
It's got close to 40 co-sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
It is right now in the committee stage. Now, anything can be killed in committee.
Mm-hmm.
But if you basically call your congressman, and if I can ever find the name of this bill, which is escaping me at the moment, if you tell them that you want them to push for biofuels, that's all you have to say, push for biofuels. They've got a bill right in front of them right now. And if they pass that bill will give $150,000. Let's imagine you own a gas station, and you're willing to put in an alternative energies pump of any kind. This bill will give you up to $150,000. Do you know how much it costs to convert a gas pump to biofuels?
How much?
$2,500.
Is that right?
$2,500, and this bill will give you up to $150,000.
All right, and do you think this bill could pass by a veto-proof margin?
Well, see, now you're implying, and you may well be right, that the guys from Bechtel and Brown and Root and whatever the name is of Dick Cheney, who just shot somebody's Dick Cheney's company, Halliburton, mm-hmm. and all of these companies that are invested in nuclear
mm-hmm.
plants in particular and in oil, that all of them might want to stop this.
No.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, yes, you do.
Well, here's the name of the bill. It's Fuel Choices for American Security Act. And all I would suggest is emailing as many senators and congressmen as you possibly can, because it's in front of both the Senate and the Congress right now, and it has 35 sponsors. It was introduced by a Republican, Jack Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
It is, among other people, co-sponsored by Joseph Lieberman, who's a Democrat. And let us hope that, and if you want to raise a stink, then by all means, send an email to the White House and tell them you want this bill. And tell them that you agree with George Bush that we are addicted to oil. And it's going to be a problem. Because, among other things, the biofuels, they're cheaper. They'll increase your horsepower. If you've got a car that's 300 horsepower right now, Art,
yes,
and you put in biofuels,
yes,
you now have a 360 horsepower car.
Now you're doing some selling.
Right, for as long as you keep those biofuels in there. Plus, you want your engine cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
The biofuels clean your engine. Plus, you want to reduce emissions, poisonous emissions into the atmosphere, so that your wife and kids can breathe tomorrow.
Yes.
So that your kids don't grow up coughing their heads off and dying of an early death because of what they breathed. These things reduce carbon emissions by 80%, according to Feng Shu, who is the head of risk analysis for NASA, and who's one of my major mentors in this. Bless him. He is really pushing me ahead on this. They reduce carbon monoxide by 40%, smog forming pollutants by 15%, greenhouse gases of other kinds by 30%, ozone pollution by 20%, et cetera. Plus, they're biodegradable.
Well, you know, you're preaching to the choir. I love this stuff. I absolutely love it, but I'm afraid that I'm an awful political cynic. And I know the realities in Washington right now.
Right.
And I don't know how. Howard, how do we know if we're driving a car that could use biofuel virtually right now?
Well, you flip the lid for the gas tank,
right?
And there should be a decal under there, if you've got a flex fuel vehicle,
mm-hmm.
that indicates the fuels you can use. Or you go to howardbloom.net, you go to the very bottom of the navigation bar on the left-hand side,
mm-hmm.
and it will show you a complete chart that will tell you whether one of your car is one of the 34 existing models. There are 34 models out there, Art.
All right.
Like four fuel vehicles.
Kim, from where? Ocala, USA, whatever that is. says biofuel and a horsepower increase is just false. It actually is about 2% less power. Now, you can absolutely refute that?
According to all of the research that I've done, not only is it a 20% horsepower increase, but I think what she's referring to is this. It takes more, if you fill your tank with gasoline.
Yes.
And you're going to get, you get 250 miles out of a full tank.
Right.
On biofuel, you'll get 200 miles.
Well, that's.
Now, it'll cost you less. I mean, it'll cost you less absolutely in terms of the miles that you've traveled. It'll cost you less. It'll do all the things we talked about in terms of an increase in horsepower. Octane has to do with the oxygen concentration, and biofuels are the highest oxygen concentration fuels of any fuel available. So that's where your power comes from. That's why you've got a boost in horsepower.
Okay, I had always been under the impression that it was slightly less horsepower myself. So you're saying, well, perhaps so if you calculate in the mileage difference.
Well, if you calculate the mileage difference, you'll come out with a conclusion that you're losing power somewhere along the way. But the fact is, they don't run race cars on biofuels. They would not run race cars on biofuels if it weren't for that horsepower difference. That's exactly why they use biofuel.
All right. Well, that will appeal to the testosterone-filled out there, no doubt.
Right.
All right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing? Hi, this is Fred. I'm in Festus, Missouri.
Hello there.
It's a pleasure to be talking to you. I've been trying to get through for the longest time.
Well, here you are.
And, boy, am I happy. I'm a little bit nervous, but happy. Question, I mean, why is it such a hard transition to go to what's better for, you know, the whole world as far as, you know, economy and the air quality? And I mean, I know it has a lot to do with money, but it just seems like, you know, people are getting just stabbed in the back over all this.
There's an answer that Art has been implying, Fred, and that is that Jimmy Carter, this is ancient history, and to a lot of people who read my books, this is before they were born, but Jimmy Carter declared the equivalent, a moral equivalent of war to make us energy independent. And there was a tremendous amount of money that was being spent on alternative sources of energy, including wind power, including solar power, and I'm not sure about any of the things we're talking about now.
And that would have been about the right timing to do it, too.
It would have been the perfect timing,
sure.
And that's about when Brazil really got into this. But then, when the Reagan administration came in the 1980s, it gutted all of those programs.
Solar panels right off the roof of the wind.
Well, what it did was we had developed these incredible wind turbines, absolutely incredible wind turbines. The Scandinavians took them over and began to manufacture them, and now they're a high revenue export business for the Scandinavians. When Enron went down the tubes, there was one profitable division of Enron, and it was their
wind power
division, because their wind, in other words, their wind farms.
Howard, is the lowest per kilowatt there is right now that I'm aware of. I believe around 7 cents.
Well, and it's going to get cheaper as more and more of these wind turbines get out there, and they are getting out there. I mean, you know that if you've driven through California or...
Yes, but I've really wondered, Howard. I live, as you know, in Nevada.
Right.
Here we have this wonderful combination of nearly sunshine all the time,
right,
or very near it, and when we don't have that, we have wind, or even when we do have sun, we have wind. We have both. Nevada could be the wind generation capital of the western United States.
Very good point, Art.
No question about it. Why aren't we?
Why aren't you? Nevada's politics have been very strange ever since the days of Richard Nixon. And what else can I tell you? I really don't have an answer aside from that. But the fact is that with the necessary political will, we're a country that is addicted to oil, and our administration is addicted to oil, and our administrations have been addicted to oil ever since 1980.
Yes.
And this is a major problem for us. whatever positive values, and there are many positive values that our administrations have had, I'm sure, over the last 25 years.
Well, I differ from you a little bit. It doesn't sound to me like you feel the Bush administration has positive values, and I'm not saying they don't have some negative ones, but, you know, I think that this administration has been doing a pretty good job of responding so far to the attack on the United States.
I think I agree with you. I mean, we can't be absolutely certain because most of the stuff that is done has to be done in secrecy.
Yes.
But I very much agree with you.
Well, I think they're doing it.
Yeah.
In secret. I think they're getting it done.
Yeah. Well, again, I agree with you. Even though I'm a lifelong Democrat, and today we're, what, 27% of the population, Democrats, nonetheless, I do agree with you. When it comes to foreign policy, I believe that this administration has been doing the right thing. When it comes to domestic policy, I'm highly disturbed. But again, let's get back to, we need to get on to alternative energy. We need to do it now.
These days, by the way,
yeah.
International and national policy are not all that inseparable.
No, because again, if you look at the, if you look at oil versus biofuels, if we got onto biofuels and off of oil, then that frees us from the Middle East. Now, as a Jew who's committed to Israel, do I want us to be totally free of the Middle East? Absolutely. I'm sorry. I want us to be totally free of the Middle East, period. If we support Israel, it's because of Israel, period. But I don't want this country to be hooked and addicted the way that it is right now. And the fact is that we do have an infrastructure that's already in place. The only missing piece of this biofuels infrastructure is the fact that we've only got 587 pumps, biofuel pumps, in this country out of 180,000 gas stations.
Mm.
So the choke point is the retail point for biofuels. And this is despite the fact that we can make biofuels from wheat, sugar, sugar beets, sweet sorghum, cane sugar, switchgrass, castor beans, wood, sawdust, garbage, and even manure. Human manure, pig manure. Doesn't matter. We can make it from all these things. So the potential is tremendous, Art.
Who do you think ultimately will make the decision, the hardcore decision? Will it be a political decision, or will it be a private industry kind of thing? Is money going to drive the whole thing? In other words, once price of energy goes up to a certain point, it's all automatic.
It's money and it's idealism because, as I said, it's a tidal wave. There are hundreds of companies involved with this. Richard Branson has started a company called Virgin Fuels.
I'm aware of it.
Okay, Bill Gates has put $40 million into biofuels.
Mm-hmm.
Arnold Schwarzenegger has put a bill in front of the Californian legislators that calls for a switch to biofuels. As I said, there are 73 companies that are already producing biofuels in the United States. There are companies like Changing World Technologies. It has a pilot plant in Philadelphia that's making these things from garbage. Mm-hmm. It has another pilot plant in Carthage, Missouri.
Heard about it, yeah.
Right next to a Butterball turkey factory, a ConAgra factory, one of the biggest. ConAgra is one of the two biggest conglomerates in agriculture in the world.
I know, but this is all almost anecdotal because it's so tiny. What I'm asking about is the real decision that will drive the change. Will it be political? Will it be economic?
I think it's economic, and I think what you're seeing, the number of people that Fortune, in its article, mentioned who are involved with this is overwhelming. The folks from Silicon Valley are taking their money and they're shoveling it into biofuels right now.
All right, here we go. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona.
Yes.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey, Howard, you're sort of like a hero to me. Back in October of 2001, a month after 9/11, you were on Art's show, and I'm going to try and paraphrase a little bit what you said. You said this is a society of new empowerment. You remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and biofuels is, to me, a transitional energy source.
I agree with you totally.
Okay, and you said that we, you know, reinvent ourselves two or three times in our lifetime, you know, horse drawn to auto, to radio, to TV, and now
right.
You said the new form is cyberspace.
Right.
okay, now how can we work with this new empowerment concept and get ourselves away from considering ourselves consumerist or a capitalist society and make something work and get rid of this fear mode we're in right now?
Hmm.
Well, for one thing, I think that the whole consumerist idea is dead wrong. I did a speech in Manhattan about 7 or 8 months ago, basically on the spiritual fruits of materialism. And you know, if you've got a computer or if you've got a cell phone, that those two devices have taken you into entirely new virtual realms. I mean, it's just like when Daniel Defoe invented the novel back in 1710, he gave us whole new virtual landscapes, real estate to work in. And when you set foot into a novel, you set foot into a world that didn't exist before the novel existed. There are ways in which, and I'm getting off, I seem to be getting off of your question, but one of the things that happens when you go into something new like biofuels is you get into it thinking only in terms of an extension from where you are today, and then somebody comes up with 15 new ideas for using this stuff that nobody ever thought of before. So every time you make a major energy transition or a major major techno transition of any kind, the unexpected gives you new human powers.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it through ways that our imaginations are not capable of conceiving right now.
All right.
We talked about the implicit parts of the cosmos that in that initial unfurling sheet of space-time,
right,
there were things, the quarks, and they came popping out like crazy. Well, there are tremendous things implicit in humans right now. And we will find out what they are explicitly by moving into the new realms like the realm of biofuels and solar energy.
All right. East of the Rockies, your turn with Howard Bloom.
Yes. Good morning, Art. How are you?
Just fine, sir.
I'm calling from Ontario, Canada. I'm just wondering, with all this, and good morning to you, Howard, too, by the way.
Hi. What's your name?
I'm sorry?
What's your name?
My name is Ronnie.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. I'm just wondering what your feeling is. You know, I've been debating this with a lot of friends in the last couple of years, you know, the hybrid as opposed to a regular fuel-type vehicle, as opposed to, you know, a totally electric vehicle. Now, I work at a company where they make batteries for satellites, actually.
Wow.
And
yeah.
The batteries that they make can power a satellite for up to 5.5 years.
Wow.
No,
yeah,
just,
they've come a long way in battery technology recently. We've really made some jumps.
It's one of the big areas where we need to go five times as far as we've ever gone before.
Yeah, but what people forget is electric cars, even with really good batteries, have still, ultimately, that power has to be generated.
That's the big problem.
There is no free lunch.
Right, exactly. So, Ronnie, back to your question.
Well, I'm just wondering what you think about that, Howard, though. You know, if they can do that and the technology is there, then why aren't we going beyond biofuels and why aren't we going more towards electric where there's no emissions whatsoever?
Because the electricity has to be made by something, and it's exactly what Art just said.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons, now, it was almost the day after George Bush made his speech about oil addiction. The Department of Energy announced that it was freeing an extra $117 million for, guess what? Not for biofuels, but for hydrogen.
Well, I was about to mention to you, the president's last major contribution to saying anything about all of this at all was to suggest that we move toward a hydrogen economy. Remember?
Okay, now here is my interpretation. And it's only an interpretation of why. Because, as you said, the secret, Art, is how you make the energy.
That's it.
And you do not make the energy when you burn hydrogen in your car. You're dependent on somebody else to make the hydrogen for you.
You bet.
And there are companies called Bechtel and Brown and Root and Halliburton. And they are all very, very big-time construction companies. Now, what are the biggest construction boondoggles domestically? I mean, aside from a war, they are nuclear reactors. They cost tons and tons of money to manufacture. So my suspicion is that George Bush is pushing hydrogen because the only way to make the hydrogen would be with nuclear plants. However, I was just talking to a person from General Electric tonight before we went on the air who's in their turbine division. Well, guess what you can, now turbines are used to generate electricity.
Right.
And guess what fuels you can use in turbines? Ethane, methane. In other words, you can use, or ethanol and methanol, you can use biofuels. Now, take the possibilities of, again, using sugarcane stalks, tree bark, cheese whey, the stuff left over when you make cheese and butter waste.
Yeah.
Land O'Lakes Butter is now making biofuels from cheese whey. So is a place called Golden Cheese making it. The beer companies are making it from brewery waste. Miller Beer is making biofuels.
All right, then. Do you think the president has had a change of mind? In other words,
no, not yet. I think Art, as a person who's been editing and writing almost all of his life, I can see in the sentence that in which he talked about our addiction to oil,
yes,
that it started out as an addiction to foreign oil and an addiction to Middle Eastern oil. It was only by some great stroke of God knows what that that sentence was rearranged so that it said oil addiction point blank. But I think it's going to take an awful lot of pressure from Ronnie, from you, from me, from everybody we know, to get this president to realize that what he said was true. And to get him moving on to, again, the one alternative that's right under our nose.
You almost sound like you think he said it by accident.
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes, because he, again, his speechwriters are very, very, very good. And they write things that are so on target sometimes that it's scary. And I think that he let them rearrange that sentence so it said what he said. But again, remember, very often George Bush does the opposite in his budgeting and his funding.
So what do you think the rest of the sentence originally said?
I think it originally said exactly what I just mentioned, that we are addicted to foreign oil. We are addicted to oil that comes from insecure sources like the Middle East, like Venezuela, like Nigeria.
Well, that's not inaccurate.
No, it's not inaccurate, but the fact is that implies that we should be drilling in Alaska, that we should stay hooked on oil. And I think that George Bush, God bless him, and I'm an atheist, but God bless him for allowing that sentence to be changed so that it said point blank, we are addicted to oil. Now let's just get him to move on it. And even if he doesn't move on it, let's support all these people. First of all, again, call your congressmen and call your senators and tell them that you want biofuels.
Well, maybe it originally said we are addicted to foreign oil, and so we need to drill in Anwar now.
Yes, that's exactly what I think was originally written into that speech.
Really?
Because the next morning, the very next morning, if you turned on C-SPAN, which I did,
yes.
Do you know what they were debating in Congress and the Senate?
Anwar. Okay. Man, here's something to think about. Kyle in Calgary, Alberta writes, and I have no idea whether he's right, but Howard, he writes, hey Art, with current technology, a solar farm 100 miles by 100 miles would be enough to displace the entire fossil fuel consumption of the U.S.
You know, I've read figures that are very similar to that.
My God.
And there is a good probability that if you couldn't do it with one solar farm, I mean, you pointed to Nevada as a giant solar farm.
We certainly have the space. Most of it belongs to the government anyway.
Right, and it's just waiting to be.
It sure is.
That one way or the other, I think that that's close to truth. Absolutely close to truth. Let me throw in some other stuff here.
Well, with the current distribution system we have, it could not be, of course, done with just one plant. But if you had one in the West, one in the Midwest, and one somewhere east, you could certainly get it done.
Well, the energy from Niagara Falls has been traveling thousands of miles for a long time.
I shouldn't have said certainly. You could, I don't know how many it would take, but with the current distribution system in mind, it could certainly be done. So you think that's a valid comment?
I think it's a valid comment. We need to check it out. It might take 5 of them. It might take 15 of them, but it's a step in the right direction.
Big one, too.
Yeah, and what, you know, I've been thinking in terms of some of the questions we've been asked, what in the world do you do to make this biofuels revolution happen? One thing that you can do is walk down or drive down to your local gas station and tell them that you want a biofuels pump. Tell them that you want an E85 pump. That's 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. When you go to buy a car...
They're probably going to say, okay, why do you want that? What kind of car are you driving?
Well, because that's the next time you buy a car. Realize you do not buy a car all that often. But when you buy a car next time, even if it's a used car, ask for a flex fuel vehicle, because these cars have been on the road in America for 10 years. You can find a 10-year-old flex fuel vehicle, or you can go down and get one of the 37 models. I mean, Chery, Chevrolet, Relay,
out of curiosity, of these 5 million flexies out there on the road, how many do you think are actually flexing and using one of the two new fuels?
I doubt that it's more than a tenth of a percentage. 99.9% of the drivers don't even know they have them.
My God.
Now, General Motors put an ad on the Super Bowl advertising its flex fuel vehicles, and its new campaign is called Live Green, Go Yellow, and they're offering a yellow gas cap to anybody who's got a flex fuel vehicle.
All right, listen, I've got a board full of people who want to talk to you, and
okay.
I could just absorb your time, but I shouldn't. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, proceed.
Your previous subject with the Iran... Iraq
yes.
situation?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You mentioned how we were maybe suckered into getting into Iraq by
That's
the
right.
Iranians.
That's right.
Okay. I remember during in the 90s, during the Kosovo situation, where a reporter had spent quite a bit of time there, he said that we were suckered into that situation by the KLA when they kept picking off police officers and security people,
yeah.
and he ended up getting the West to do the work for them to get rid of the Serbs.
And there's a validity to that.
Yeah, okay, well, so we get, I guess we get pulled into a lot of things for various reasons.
Well, the Kosovo Liberation Army was an Islamic army. Osama bin Laden was putting a lot of money. And this is not kidding around. Just read his speeches, and he'll tell you this. He was putting a lot of money and manpower into the Kosovo situation. We were brought in on one side. There were two sides that were committing atrocities. One side was the Islamic side, which we know of as the Albanians. I mean, it's the Albanians. And the other side was the Christian side, and the Christian side was producing genocide, and the Islamic side was trying to produce genocide. And we should have been stopping the genocide in both cases.
All right.
On both fronts.
All right. Question, Howard. If we catch and or kill Osama bin Laden tomorrow.
Nothing stops.
Well, you anticipated me.
Nothing stops.
All right.
First of all, remember the song John Brown's Body Lies a Moldering in the Grave, but
yeah.
His Truth Goes Marching On?
Yeah.
A man who has established himself as a historical icon is a man whose spirit is going to live on for a long time to come. And Osama has established that mark on history. And again, this is a 1,400-year-long global war, world war. And the one religious system that is set up for global governance and has been from the very beginning is Islam. I'll leave that dangling without explaining it because we're...
Short on time. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Hi.
Good morning, Art and Howard.
Yes.
Hi.
This is Vince from Denver, and my question is this. I've heard it said that there's more oil shale reserves in Colorado than there is oil reserves in Saudi Arabia. My question to you would be, if we could find a way to bring it out as cheaply as we could buy Middle East oil, would you, and thereby making the U.S. Independent of foreign sources of oil, would you still be against the use of oil?
I'd say kick it out, forget it. What we have to get off oil one way or the other. There are also vast oil shale fields in Canada. Forget it. Forget oil. It's time to get oil out of our system.
Well, there's the atmosphere issue as well.
Absolutely.
And that's not a trivial issue. It really isn't. We've got to stop burning fossil fuels.
Right.
That's all there is to it. We've got
right.
to. Or else.
Right.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Howard Bloom.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
This is Jeffrey. I'm calling you from the hurricane-ravaged Gulf Coast.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Jeffrey.
I have a question. Actually, it's a statement, then a question. I have noticed that, and I defy anybody to tell me different, that in the 70s, early 70s, a gentleman came out with a carburetor that would get 50 and 60 miles to the gallon, and a petroleum company snapped up the patent on that and set on it.
Yeah. Well, is there any truth to that, Howard? Have you?
Well, I frankly have to tell you that I wouldn't know. I've heard stories like that for a long time.
We
They're
all have.
Myth,
yeah.
And it's very hard to tell. We do know that British Petroleum has a very active alternative energy department, but whether they're sitting on things and hiding them from us instead of getting them to us, it's hard to say.
Sir, they probably got that carburetor. They got it in deep into Detroit somewhere, and
well,
they squeezed the inventor right through it.
I'll tell you something very, very fishy. In doing the research on biofuels, General Motors announced, both General Motors and Ford announced that they're going on major programs to make biofuels available at your gas station, at a gas station near you. Now, I told you we've only got something like 187 or 587 pumps in a country with 180,000 gas stations. Do you know how many new pumps they're putting in this massive effort that they're doing with Sun Oil?
How many?
Or Shell Oil, sorry. They're putting in additional 75 pumps.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Well, see, that's exactly what I really wanted to know. It seems to me it's got to be the oil companies that do this. And until it is the oil companies, it ain't going to get done.
And I agree with you totally. I mean, we had a branding, head of a branding company who works with one of the major oil companies who came out to this very bedroom about 4 months ago. And I told him, look, Shell is going to be dead in 25 to 30 years if they don't realize that their future is the future of energy. And the future of energy is getting off of oil and onto the next form of energy.
Do you believe we're at peak oil?
Yes, I do believe. I mean, you know, in a sense, it's irrelevant. Yes, I believe that we're going to peak, but we need to get off of oil one way or the other for the very reason that you just mentioned. Right now, we are eating carbon in forms that are unacceptable to our bodies. We are eating poisons, we're breathing poisons.
Well, you see,
we might as well be eating them.
Howard, in a couple of more hurricane seasons, maybe even just one,
right.
American awareness is going to jump up several levels. I can promise you that.
Well, there's a tricky thing there, and that's a whole different subject for another time, but there have been 144 mass extinctions on this planet long before there were human beings and long before we were turning out carbon dioxide. And the lesson of that is we have to become adaptable to change no matter what, because nature's going to throw it at us if we don't throw it at ourselves.
Well, nature has begun to throw it at us, Howard. It's just a matter of when people stop buying the, well, it's just a freakish peak of all peaks and valleys. There is a real weather change going on, Howard.
Right, and that's nature's norm. You know that the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere has been 200 times what it is today, long before a human being ever appeared on this planet.
Mm-hmm. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, sir. Go ahead.
Sort of a philosophical question. What do you think, Howard, about closing our borders as far as terrorists coming in? And then I was also thinking on the other side of the coin, when Ronald Reagan was doing the Star Wars research.
Yes.
And you were talking about microwaves and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, what good would any of them do if, you know, hijackers can come in, terrorists can come in and hijack a plane and go through a building? And one last thing, I wanted to
know. Right, a power plant or something of the sort.
Yeah, that's a couple of good questions, really. Some of the Star Wars technology could be used in the power gathering and transmission satellites that we were talking about a little while ago. But
that would be terrific.
Please do comment on the border situation.
The border situation, America's great strength in the world. Look, we all know that the coming century is, on all probability, going to be the Chinese century. And because they've got 1.25 billion people, and those people have been students. They have been busy studying. They have been accustomed to working night and day for at least 2,200 years now. They put out their first encyclopedias 2,000 years ago. There are five times as many of us as there are of them. If we want to stay ahead in this world, it's because we have the advantage of being a mongrel culture who have taken the best of all kinds of different cultures. There are Slavic peoples here. There are Anglo-Saxon peoples here. There are African-American peoples here. And every time we gain a new kind of people, it gives us a new kind of energy and a new kind of strength. So if we're going to compete with the Chinese successfully in the next century, it's going to be in part because of the creativity and innovation that is created by our hybrid nature.
I really would be hard-pressed to argue with that. I really do agree with that. And I know there's a big angry movement right now with regard to the borders, but what you say has great merit, and I don't think that a nation can afford to just sort of stick its head into the sand, and if it does, then others will race right by it.
Well, the last time that people tried sticking their heads in the sand in a big way was about 600 A.D., and do you know what happened as a result? Something called the Dark Ages, and it was horrible. Half of the population of Europe died because everybody decided to be enclosed and safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember the bird flu. First time caller line, you're on the air with Howard Bloom. Hello.
Hello, Howard and Art. I have a problem with Mr. Bloom's assertion that ethanol and methanol are such great things after watching Ralph Nader testify against these fuels.
All right. What did he say that made you buy into it?
Well, Mr. Green Party himself came out and pointed out the Office of Congressional Research had shown that ethanol and methanol is very harsh fuel on vehicles. You definitely have to have a vehicle.
It's very harsh on vehicles, and that's why the invention of the flex fuel engine has been such a remarkable thing, because whereas these fuels will corrode a normal vehicle, they'll just eat through it. They will not eat through a flex fuel vehicle. These are vehicles that have been specially made so they can handle either ethanol, methanol, or gasoline. So
regardless of that, Nader pointed out that the Office of Congressional Research had shown that the ethanol and methanol vehicles increased, in some cases, hydrocarbons, definitely increased ozone pollution, and were known to produce the carcinogen formaldehyde when you burn any type of alcohol.
Well, okay, let me step in, Howard, and make it easy on you. You're not really suggesting these as permanent replacements for oil.
No, they're a temporary stop along the way.
Temporary.
Yeah.
Headed toward,
first of all, the plug-ins, which only become practical, as you know, Art, once the source of energy for producing the alternatives, the gasoline or the hydrogen, once those become sustainable.
Like with the power gathering group of satellites in orbit.
The power grouping satellites in orbit, turning Nevada into one of the biggest energy centers in the world, et cetera.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you are on the air with Howard Bloom. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Howard. How are you gentlemen today?
Hi.
I'm in South Dakota. We are, and you were talking about the ethanol, we currently have like six ethanol plants here in Sioux Falls or in South Dakota. They got like another 17 on the book. So this is something
that is going away. One of them produces 120 million gallons a year.
Oh, yeah. They're huge. Like I said, they got 17 more on the books that they want to have completed in the next 2 to 3 years. So, I mean, this is something that's not going to go away. It's here to stay for a while anyway.
Right.
Now, you said there's how many ethanol pumps right now in the U.S.?
587.
It's not enough for Rhode Island.
No, it's not. I know in the last, I'll be honest with you, the last couple of years, they've really sprung up here in South Dakota, but then we're in corn country, too, so that would be part of it.
Well, one of the remarkable things about ethanol and methanol is that a state like Missouri has gotten very into, okay, if the Americans don't want to become energy independent, that doesn't mean that we in Missouri don't want to become energy independent, so let's become energy independent. And they are pushing the heck out of using their own fuels made in their own territory. You can't make gasoline in any territory you choose, but you can make ethanol and methanol in any Midwestern state you choose. They're talking about having a Midwestern ethanol corridor, and Illinois and Missouri are the two states that are leading right now. But you're right, South Dakota has one of these giant plants that's being that has been up and operating and is run by Verison, which is a company that both General Motors and Ford have partnered with for this biofuels revolution. And as I said, it's a very weak start to a biofuels revolution when you're only putting in an extra 70 pumps. But that's where we've got to all put the pressure. That's why it's in my neighborhood, where gasoline is frowned on even though everybody owns an SUV. If we all just walked down to our local gas station a block and a half away from here and told them in no uncertain terms we want an ethanol or methanol, a biofuels pump, believe me, with enough pressure, they'd put one in.
Do you own an SUV, Howard?
No, I own a pair of shoes, actually bedroom slippers, and I go everywhere by subway and foot. But New York is one of the only cities you can get away with that in the world.
Well, that's true. That's true. In New York City, you can indeed get away with that. I just wanted to see if indeed you were, walking the walk.
Walking the walk.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Howard Bloom and not a lot of time, so.
Okay. Good morning, Art and
morning.
Howard. Good to talk to you. I'm actually really happy to get through because I'm in a business program here in Northern California in Santa Rosa, and we're studying sustainable business practices, and my focus is actually to start a business that has an alternative fuel station.
That would be great.
As its core business model. So I've got a lot of connections already established in that field. My question to you is, what role do you see yourself having in this developing business?
Well, about 2 weeks ago, when I discovered that this is an avalanche about to happen, it is a tidal wave about to happen,
definitely,
I turned to all of the members of the Aerospace Technology Working Group and said, guys, are we really necessary? And all of the guys said yes. And my role in life has generally been as a catalyst because I work across disciplines.
Okay, we're almost out of time.
Yeah, in so many different directions, it's pulling people together and pulling together a coalition of all of these hundreds of companies that are involved so we can push this through like crazy.
All right, caller, a yes or no answer. Your business model that you wrote up?
What about it?
Does it show it's profitable?
So far, things are looking good.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Howard, it has been a pleasure to have you on the air. It always is.
You're a joy, and you've gotten me to say things that I have never said on the air before. I'm sure I'm going to lose all of my readers. So.
I doubt that. You want to plug your website or something?
Yeah, howardbloom.net. And again, to find out whether you've got a flex fuel vehicle, go down the left-hand side of the page to the bottom. And the other website is bigbangtango.net.
All right. You've done it. Good night, Howard.
All right. You're a joy.
Take care.